Welcome to The Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Marvel's latest struggles and potential recasting controversy. Reviews of It's a Wonderful Knife and The Marsh King's Daughter, an interview with Carnival creator and screenwriter Daniel Knopf. It's an elongated interview. I think you guys are going to enjoy that. A lot of fun there. And our topic this week revolves around celebrity deaths. Why do they impact us so much? Why do they hurt us? Let's get on with the show. My name is Aaron Peterson. Joining me today, my fellow host, John Davenport.
Hey, everybody. I just want to let you all know that that's not some sort of editing trick Aaron just did. He really was talking that fast.
Okay. Amanda Sink.
Hello, hello.
And Troy Heinrichs.
I don't know what I heard because I listened to it twice as fast. So it just sounded like...
Yeah, you do listen. You listen to this podcast, every podcast at 2x speed, right?
Well, it's because you train your brain after you listen to somebody for a long period of time. You can gradually ramp it up over 10 years.
Do you ever think that's why you're always interrupting people? Because you think they're done when they're still talking at a normal speed?
Yeah, I already heard the end of their sentence before they finished it. So yeah, that's totally why I jump in.
I'm just saying it could be a problem. Well, hey, what's going on, guys? We weren't here last week, technically. Anyone do anything fun or exciting? I met up with Amanda in Colorado. We went to the Stanley Hotel. So that's worth mentioning.
For Halloween. That's cool.
Did you have a drink?
Did I have a drink?
Yeah, the bar.
Yeah, I didn't see any dead children or anything.
Did you survive the maze?
Yeah, the maze, they reinvent the maze. It's really like shrubs that I could jump over. But
yeah, I was like, what is this, a maze for ants?
It's a pretty easy maze. God bless them. I don't want to get stuck out there like, you know, Scatman Crothers or whatever. But it's a very cool hotel if you've never been. It's the inspiration for The Shining, which means not where they actually film the movie The Shining, but they did film the TV series there.
Oh, that's a fun fact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty cool. I didn't do anything interesting at all. I was actually really upset that there was not even any trick-or-treaters where I live. Apparently, there's the whole trunk-or-treat movement really ruined trick-or-treating for some people.
What do you mean?
I was thinking about that too, because there's a lot of people who are saying like they'll take their kids and do trunk or treat and those events like over the weekend, and then on Halloween they're not trick or treating door to door. But in some ways I can understand why. Like at least then it's like safer because you know who's there. And also you can guarantee that like every place is going to have candy, so it's kind of quicker usually. So that way you're not having to like walk outside in the snow or something.
I had a conversation with a friend of mine who's got like a 3-year-old. And I said, did you go check the candy when it's done? And he goes, no, because nothing like that's happened since 1982. So there's really no need to constantly still check the candy. It's fine.
Go take it and get x-rayed.
Yeah. The old days where you got to do it. Otherwise there may be a razor blade inside.
Yeah. Yeah. I live in an older neighborhood, so a lot of the people here are, I would say, elder statesmen, I guess you can call them. In my conversations with them, they were all really kind of disappointed that nobody rang their doorbells or they got to see any sort of kids do anything, because that's something they look forward to.
I would have went to each one of their houses and said, I'll take that for you. You don't need it.
I was one of those people. I was a little sad. There weren't that many. I mean, I had more than some people do, but... And it was also really weird for my neighborhood. My neighborhood, there's not like a set time. It's just whenever people feel like starting to whenever people feel like stopping.
That's the way it's supposed to be.
I know, but I haven't had that since I was a kid.
Well, like, that's they because put rules when you were a kid, you could have gotten shot.
Well, now we're into Christmas music. So I was at the store today and I heard literal Christmas music from the time I entered to the time I left. And I just don't understand because it's still... pretty early November. I mean, can't we just put the Hanukkah song on or Thanksgiving song on, like Adam Sandler? Can we just play that in rotation or something rather than Mariah Carey?
I mean, it fit because I went as Jim Cantore from the Weather Channel for Halloween because we had a snow blizzard. Literally, as everybody was trick-or-treating, straight line winds, 2 inches.
Did you go back to Halloween when I was trying to move past it?
Yeah, he
never
totally
got
did.
Jesus goddamn Christ.
I never got to say what I did.
Right.
Okay.
Everybody else is worrying about everybody else. It's fine. Just go ahead.
I didn't talk about, I was Malibu Ken. Suck it. I didn't talk about me either.
I was trying to combine the two together. All right.
I know, but we're 2 weeks past Halloween. Look, we're in Thanksgiving time, not Christmas time. That's all I'm saying is I just don't want to hear Christmas music yet. There needs to be some middle music. We go from creepy to something to Christmas. I can't have the Christmas right now.
I'm all about the Christmas right now. Let it happen. I mean, it's been, there's a lot of people who are still struggling. There's a lot of people who are still having hard times. Let them have their Christmas music. Let them have something to smile about.
No. No, I say no.
I get it.
They can wait until it's Christmas time.
All right.
I put my tree up yesterday.
Jesus H. Christ. Are you kidding me right now?
That's only because I bought a new one and I had to pull it out of the car. So I was like, why am I going to
carry
it?
Why
don't
you start with that segue instead of going backwards?
Well, because it doesn't change the fact that he put a tree up yesterday.
Exactly. Jesus. Because I'm lazy because I don't want to carry it up to the attic and then pull it out in 2 weeks. So I just set it up now.
Honestly, that makes sense. That's good. That's good boy math.
That's called 2X Christmas.
Jesus. I've had the same tree for, I think, 30 years. And every year I'm like, I'm getting a new one. And I haven't.
So all your branches are breaking and falling off.
Yeah, they're duct taped on. Yeah, I'm good with them.
Somewhere in North Carolina, there's a tree of mine from when I was a kid. And I have to figure out where in my mom's house it is. Because I haven't found it yet.
It's like Charlie Brown Christmas tree now.
It is.
It's supposed to be my Christmas tree.
I hope Lucy holds that ball for you this year. I really do.
Let's be honest. Lucy's been holding the ball
all
entire
the time. I was just going to say that same thing.
Let's run into some movie and TV news. We've got some stuff to get to. In the interview with Daniel Knopf, if you don't know, Daniel Knopf created Carnival. He also worked on The Blacklist. He's worked on a lot of television. Spartacus, Dracula, a lot of television.
Supernatural.
He did an episode of Supernatural. Nickelodeon's The Astronauts. And we're going to have a whole interview Troy and I did with him. It's about an hour. We talk about the WGA strike. We talk about our topic on this. You know, why do you think celebrity deaths impact people so much? We talk about those shows that he worked on and why they were so impactful and some little secrets behind those shows. So, yeah, it's definitely worth listening to, and we're going to have that at the end of the episode. Right now, some TV news. So Yellowstone's final episodes return in late 2024. That's confirmed, as well as more spinoffs, 1944, as well as the next version of Yellowstone, which is only called 2024 at this point. It'll be called something else. It's thought to star Matthew McConaughey. Also, House of the Dragon Season 2 returns summer 2024 because they were able to film during the strikes for whatever reason. Last of Us Season 2 is being shot planned in early 2024 for our 2025 release, as is White Lotus Season 3 and Euphoria. And Hulu is in the early process of a reboot of Prison Break with all new characters. And that's funny because Hulu is going to be all bought up by Disney soon. That's a lot of stuff happening
for a
town that isn't working.
Because it's all like, you know, hey, this is coming. This is coming. This is coming. This is coming. Which means we've heard the same thing from Marvel, and it's like, this is coming, and then it's all pushed back. It's pushed back. And
the Hulu thing is definitely happening.
I'm excited for that.
Why? For people that don't understand, basically Comcast still had a stake in Hulu. Disney's buying that out for $8 billion. So now Disney will own all of Hulu, so they can have more adult content regularly. Why do you think that's great, Troy?
Well, I think it's great that it's just owned by one person, so that way you don't have this like weird sharing of information, and Comcast can just focus on its own thing and Disney can focus on its bundle that it's been pushing in my Facebook ads every single day since they raised the prices. But no, I'm just more excited for the Prison Break part of it. Like, I think it'd be fun to see new characters and understand like where the legacy ties in with the company and all the things that we got to see throughout the entire course of the series and how that plays out in a reboot. And if the first season does well, it's going to be great. If it's going to be like 24, then it's going to suck, right?
I bet you they're going to ignore all that stuff. All of it.
If they do, then it's going to suck, right? They have to tie it into the mythology or it's not going
to
work.
No, they don't. No.
Yeah, they don't have to.
They don't need to do that. The 24 reboot was a flop.
That was different, though. They were trying to be in the same world. If they did like just a Prison Break, why do we need to be tied into all of the stuff that weighed down the previous show? Because that was stuff that weighed the show down.
It's LJ, and LJ is now in jail because he can't do anything right.
I wouldn't watch that. I would not. There are already people saying, well, it's got to have Teabag in it. I'm like, no, then it's the same show. I always thought that would be a cool anthology show. Every year, it's a different prison with different people trying to figure out how to get out. So you never know who's going to make it, who's going to live.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
That would be cool. Mm-hmm.
And then in season 10, they all meet up because it's like, you know, Mad Mad World or something. And they're chasing for...
They just have like a meetup spot, yep, like at Starbucks or something.
Oh, that would be cool.
Prison Break, the final rat race.
HBO has been found to be ordering employees to create secret profiles online to essentially retaliate against poor reviews of their shows. HBO and Max CEO Casey Bloys, well, I'm going to call blow it out your ass, Bloys, apologize to TV critics for this. Yeah, you can kiss my sweet ass, man. I think that is just pathetic. Absolutely pathetic.
I mean, isn't that the same thing we always do? Sorry. Go ahead.
Just say it. Just say it, and then I'll say mine.
Can't help himself.
I was looking at the format. I didn't see Amanda's name was tied there. Sorry.
It's okay. Just say it.
Go, go, go.
No, I'm leaving all this in. Everybody can enjoy this.
I didn't have the screen up. I'm sorry, okay? Just go, go.
I gotta wait for John.
I'm just... It just...
Oh, it's so cute when John's happy and laughing. I love it.
He couldn't help himself at all.
Well, motherfucker doesn't have a name on the first one, and then he's got a name on the second one. Like,
he's got no stop buttons. He's just wait, winding up. Stop talking. And then
I love the fact that everyone's going to see and hear exactly what Aaron's constantly talking about. Okay, I'm going to mute myself now.
Amanda, what do you got to say about this?
Yeah, I mean, above the fact that this is just absurd and childish, it's also just incredibly unprofessional. And I also find it very cowardly, because if you want to respond as yourself. I feel like going out of your way to make fake accounts so that way you can tell people, hey, screw you, I like my show.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's, I don't know, that's just cowardly and weak, in my opinion. If you want to be tough and you want to say to critics who are doing their job, hey, screw you for doing your job and doing this, you know, appropriately, and sorry that I made something that you guys didn't like, you're just going to sit behind your keyboard and your fake profiles. It's embarrassing for you, Casey.
It is. It's really sad. It's just weird. Guys, I want to hear this meeting. Here's what I want you to do. We're getting trashed on this show, all right? Nobody likes, what was the one with The Weeknd? What was that one? And Lily Rose Depp.
The Idol?
What I'm talking
about? Huh? The Idol. That's what it is.
Yeah, Idol. The Idol. So, guys, The Idol is not getting great reviews. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to go create a Twitter account, or X account, as it were, or as it is now. And your name is Stevie Steamroll. And you just go on to all the critics.
Stevie Steamroll?
Stop. I can't think of clever names because my name's Casey Blowed Out Your Ass. So go do that and then go trash those people for all their bad reviews. Anybody that wrote a good review, go praise them. Say, good job. Go team. But if you see a bad review, trash that review. It's just, that's how we handle this. That's how we maturely handle this problem.
Janet Sock Puppet Jones.
Yeah, exactly. Damn it, Janet.
Oh, I love Janet. All right. I mean, at least he owned it and apologized.
He didn't own it. He got busted. Yeah. Rolling Stone busted him. And that's why, shit, I got busted. It's kind of like, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
The camcorder caught you leaving the prostitute's room. And then suddenly, oh, sorry, honey. Yeah,
it's very specific.
I'm going to own this.
But some people do double down when they're quote unquote found out, you know?
Are you trying to defend this in some way?
No, I'm just trying to find a positive here.
Well, he was caught. That's positive. Let's move on to Variety's article. Variety released an in-depth piece on the struggles at Marvel, and there were several intriguing items we're going to discuss here in a second. But I do want to mention Marvel did drop this bomb after this article came out, I guess looking for some positivity for them. Marvel Spotlight is a new platform that they have that is coming out to bring more grounded, character-driven stories to the screen. And in the case of Echo, focusing on street-level stakes over a larger MCU continuity. Just like comics fans don't need to read Avengers or Fantastic Four to enjoy a Ghost Rider Spotlight comic, our audience doesn't need to have seen other Marvel series to understand what's happening in Maya's story. Sounds like a complete reversal from everything they've told us for the last couple of years. Does it not?
Yeah, it really does sound like a complete reversal. The whole idea that Marvel's been wanting to do is to create this universe where everything interacts with one another. But now they're like, okay, we're going to go back to smaller things. And on one hand, it makes sense because they can't keep doing these massive epic stories.
They just can't keep up.
Yeah. Especially if they're going to start doing things where it's, you got to watch a television show or you got to watch a movie and all these other things. People don't have that kind of time anymore or the attention spans to be able to keep up with this. So yeah, it is a reversal. It's kind of a smart reversal, but I don't know. I sort of feel like it's a little late. Troy, knock it off.
Play with, you could do that. I mean, the content's not the problem. It's the timing and the delivery of the content.
Bullshit. The content is the problem. There's too much and it's not very good.
Well, it's too much too fast, right?
And it's not very good.
And it's not very good.
Not very good is a problem with the content.
Stereo, we're available. That in.
Well, yeah. I think taking what we saw, I mean, if you were to redo this, right? If Marvel did this the right way, like not that Star Wars is like better in quality-wise, but it's more tolerable and more digestible because they're waiting. They're waiting like 6 months in order to release the next thing. It's like there's time to like miss it before the next thing comes out. You know, Marvel, it was like new series ended, new series started. Series ended, new series started. It was like Falcon and Wanda and like all that just felt like it dropped like every single day. It was just an overload at the front end of it. That by the time you got to where we are now, where it's a little bit more, oh, we need something to drop that's new when the next thing ends because people are going to unsubscribe when the show is over. Like now the pacing seems a little bit more realistic, so it's easier to keep up with it. But I think the other problem they're having is that they're tying it together. Like we're talking about maybe like, should we go backwards, right? And do content that's in the past that still fits into the old 10 years of MCU that we wanted to see from before. Star Wars did a good job of that early on, coming back and doing Clone Wars after the prequels, right? So it's a matter of come up with a good story and stick it in the timeline where it makes sense instead of trying to make Phase 4 happen, right?
But Disney wasn't involved with that at all.
Right.
Yeah, and I gotta say, I mean, I hope you get your new job at Marvel that you're shooting for, but
right.
That's just total. I can't agree with anything you said because their content has been bad for the last couple of years. Like, most of those shows were not good. I couldn't even watch most of them to completion. They based everything on them all being connected. And now they realize that the oversaturation has killed the whole brand because people aren't getting excited for Marvel properties anymore. The Marvel's box office is, you know, by the time you hear this, it might already be out and it's already forecast to go less than Black Adam and The Flash made, which were considered flops at the time. That's not good. You know, Marvel's brand is damaged, like severely damaged. And this is just trying to course correct because they realize finally, or Bob Iger realizes, you guys just did too much. You spent too much money. We're not getting any bang for our buck. There's no impact. And I think Star Wars has the same problem. I don't think it's a different problem. It's the exact same problem. I don't feel like there's a 6 month break between Star Wars shows.
To Troy's point on this, everybody is kind of agreeing that we had way too much content in the beginning. It wasn't fleshed out in its plan. Now we're like, they just really did kind of one of those roller coasters. Oh, we're going to drop everything, get everybody really excited about our streaming service. We're going to put something out every month, every couple weeks. Some of it's going to be good. Most of it's going to be good. And then all of a sudden you start to go down on the decline where there's less saturation and they did overcorrect. Mm-hmm. But also to your point, Aaron, the shows lost a lot of their interest from viewers. They tried using a lot of newer properties that hadn't had like an establishment or a foundation built for them well enough to get people interested. And then on top of that, they're also not good shows. Like, they didn't create them very well. And the most disappointing thing in all of this for me is that up until phase four, it felt like Marvel had a plan, even when they didn't have a plan. Everything connected so well in the movies. You know what I mean? Like everything was so well connected. And even when they did do something that was like, oh, that wasn't, we didn't expect that, or that wasn't on the docket, it made sense. Now we're in a place where it's like, that feels messy and disjointed and very, I don't want to compare it to its competitor, but very DC, where it's very disjointed and it doesn't feel like there's a seamless vision and that there's a good direction at the helm of it.
Zack Snyder is smiling just hearing you say that.
Oh, you're welcome, Zach.
The problem with DC was that it decided it needed to compete with Disney and Marvel as opposed to doing its own thing. And because people with the loudest voice, although the smallest amount of people, were the ones who were saying that it's bad because it's not Marvel, which is a terrible reason to course correct. Not a point that needs to be brought up, with the exception of Marvel is now competing with Marvel and doesn't know how to course correct from competing with Marvel. That's and true. They are now completely lost ever since they've put a beautiful bow on a beautiful story with Endgame. They're like, okay, what's next? And Aaron, what is next?
All right. Well, let's start. We're going to break these down. Please stay on topic, kids. We're going to start with Marvel still looking at the Kang angle, right? Meaning, do they recast Kang? This is from that Variety article. Due to Jonathan Majors' ongoing legal issues. And it should be noted, his former agent, CAA, dropped him before the domestic abuse allegations due to his treatment of their staff. So there is a little bit of a pattern here. Or do they reshape their upcoming films and center on a new villain, such as Dr. Doom? So I guess the question being, because they don't have this answer yet, John, Mr. Comic book guy, do they recast? Do they change villains? What do we want here?
I don't like Kang as a villain because he just, to me, he's just uninteresting. Is he easy to recast? Oh, yeah. Marvel's already figured out how to completely recast him. Look how many different Lokis there are. So they can go ahead and recast him to somebody completely different, and it's going to be okay. I think one of the better moves would be to do something with Dr. Doom or the villain from Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, which are both two different people.
The High Evolutionary?
The High Evolutionary.
Sure.
You know, both of those would be a much more interesting story. You go with the High Evolutionary just because it's a way to include the Marvel Universe as a whole. Or you go with Dr. Doom if you want to keep it all Earth-centric and something that's more down to earth, more easy to build a relatable story around. And there's a lot of people who are involved that you can actually bring in that they're already talking about bringing in, like the Fantastic Four, so on and so forth. So, you know, they can redo Apocalypse because now they have the mutant storyline to work with as well.
Oh, but that was so well done. That sarcasm and snark. I'll wrap up with one.
But even with the mutant storyline, you have other mutant villains that you can pull in that aren't Apocalypse or aren't Magneto. You have Sinestro. I can't even think of some of the other ones. But there's other ways you can actually bring in villains that would be just as impactful as Kang would have been, because let's face it, you're not going to, they went too big too fast by making Thanos the main villain of the first phases.
Well, I don't agree with that portion, but I think Thanos worked perfect. I don't really think there's any problem with how they did Thanos.
I don't think there's a problem with Thanos either. I just think that it's too big of a villain because nobody's going to match up to that.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
Yeah, that's a fair point, okay. At least.
That is I can see point. That. I misunderstood your point. Kang, right. I don't find that interesting. Agreed. I'm on board with that. I don't find him to be an interesting villain. Nothing against Major's performance. I think Majors is a fine actor. He's a good actor. I don't think he's a great actor. I think he's a good actor. And but Kang isn't doing anything for me. Quantumania sucked. Sorry. And Kang was a big part of it. I don't want a whole movie of that.
Kang doesn't bother me at all because the motivations of Kang seem like they're along those same lines as what Thanos's might have been, and maybe it's too similar, but Kang isn't the issue. Majors was the issue for me. I thought Majors was wet paint in the whole movie, even when they did like the whole propagation and AI and 3D models and that arena scene at the end. I was like, this is ridiculous. Like the High Evolutionary, I'm totally going to butcher his name, right? Iwuji. that actor like seethed villain the entire movie. Like, you need a villain kind of actor, and Majors just doesn't come across as a villain actor. This is like, yeah, I'm awesome, I'm cool, I'm boss, I own the world, I own the universe. Like, it was just boring. That's the problem. It was boring.
Yeah, if Kang was a character that I gave a shit about, then I would say, you know what? They've recast before. They could do it again, you know, as long as they do it properly and like they did before. But this isn't one that I think matters enough for us to get our panties in a bunch over. Like, let's just cut it out, move on, you know, reshape our vision and move forward. Like, it should be that simple.
I mean, speaking of reshaping, it's been 2 years since a being came out of the earth, and no one's mentioned it in anything.
The Eternals. I just saw somebody posted a screenshot of that today or yesterday or something like that. I think we did on our Facebook or X or whatever. But yeah, no one's mentioned it. Like, satellites aren't picking this up. Elon and his goddamn satellites aren't picking this up when they're roaming the world. That there's a hand sticking out of the planet now.
Don't forget the head. And the head's also stick.
Sure.
Yeah, that doesn't raise question at all.
I'd love to see Dr. Doom. I think that's a great character that hasn't been done right yet. So
right. No, he would be a great character, because if you want somebody who can not only be a villain, he can also be understood as a villain. And sometimes you're going to go, oh, well, he's got kind of a point.
Well, and you can introduce him. Everything's about the multiverse right now. That's a perfect connection, because he's already been introduced in another Marvel property previously, twice. So,
and you tease
that to branch it.
And you tease it in Doctor Strange, right? In the Multiverse of Madness. You already had the Fantastic Four and the tie into X-Men. And it's like, that should have been that's the on-ramp right there. Let's just go and forget about the Avengers and go straight into X-Men and mutants.
Well, easy there. I like my Avengers movies. Now we're going to move into the one that I care about most. Marvel's Blade almost lost Mahershala Ali because he was frustrated with the weak script, which at one point, this is according to sources, made Blade the fourth lead among a group of women filled with life lessons. I don't know if that's true. With the current state of comic book the world, I believe everything and don't believe anything at the same time. Whatever it is, Mahershala Ali was about ready to leave because it wasn't the Blade story he assumed it would be. So now they've tasked Logan writer Michael Green to re-script this film. It's going to have a budget of less than $100 million because Marvel's trying to bring down these insane budgets. For example, to give you an example of like how crazy these budgets have gotten, She-Hulk, which was what, a half hour show? Wasn't it a half hour?
It vacillated in size or length.
Sure, you use your fancy
words. Average of 42 minutes, probably.
Whatever. It costs $25 million per episode for that show.
That's insane. That is just insane.
So they're trying to bring these costs down because, I mean, each Marvel movie now is like $250, $300 million. So if they don't make $800 million, it's not profitable. Like Quantumania was considered a flop. It made a little less than $500 million worldwide.
As it should be. It was a terrible movie.
It was, but, you know, most movies would be like, hey, we did good. No, nope, not Marvel movies. They got to do $700-800 million to be considered profitable. Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, Jason Blum's out there counting his stacks of money for no good reason.
Yeah.
Laughing at everybody.
Five Nights at Freddy's crushed, you know, and it had hardly any budget, made nothing but profit, and it streamed the same day and still made a killing. It's wild. So, you know, what do you guys think about the Blade scenario? I, for one, am very happy that they're getting a screenwriter of talent. They're streamlining this. They pushed the release date to 2025 to give it time to be done correctly, because I think Mahershala Ali will be a fantastic Blade, and there's no reason to recast. So we need to get it done.
He will be. Yeah, he's got to be one of the best candidates that I could have even imagined putting into this. And honestly, if your lead is feeling that frustrated and telling you like, hey, this is not good, and it's to the point where Marvel did a reevaluation and they're like, yeah, you're right. This is not good. Go ahead and rewrite this script. Then it sounds like he made the right call. And honestly, I kind of wish some more actors would do this. I probably shouldn't say that, because then things will get out of control. give somebody an inch, they take a mile.
Yeah, there's already enough egos in Hollywood.
Yeah, seriously. But I'm totally in line with this, and I love the fact that we've got our Logan writer in this because Logan was great. So it makes me more interested. I mean, I was already fully on board, but now I'm like, okay, cool. You've got me signed up.
Are we getting a check?
She is, apparently.
Yeah.
Apparently.
I'm just glad they're going to like tailor it so that the budgets are in line. Because like going back to She-Hulk, right? You're talking...
Oh, I thought Taylor Swift was going to show up. Okay.
Maybe.
I'm like, well, that would make sense this year.
It would make Marvel more interesting. Made the Chiefs more interesting.
Shake it off.
She could be Captain Marvel. There is a conspiracy theory about her having a part in one of the upcoming Marvel concepts.
Don't spoil it. I don't want to know.
Well, better than Bree. Bree's better on the HBO show she's on. Much better. Yeah, She-Hulk, 26 minutes an episode over 9 episodes? That's $225 million on a TV series.
You mean the Apple show she's on, right?
Yeah, the Apple show. Sorry.
I'm sorry. And then I'll go back to my corner.
And then like when John and I were talking about the creator, you know, $80 million to make the creator, the effects are so much better than what She-Hulk's effects were by it.
Agreed.
By a light year. So it's like just focus on the story and not worrying about what the shot to shot effects are going to be. Cause I think I feel like it's like they're writing the jokes before they write the story kind of thing. So it's almost like Marvel's writing the effects before or in the fight scenes before they're writing the content. Like we need to get back to just writing the story.
Agree. And it should be noted that Blade director Yann Demange has confirmed it's going to be an R-rated movie. So they're going for it. Marvel is opening up the availability of R-rated films into their universe. We've got Deadpool 3. We've got Blade. What else will we get next? I don't know. Let's move on. I'm not against this one as much as I thought I would be. Okay, so there have been internal discussions about creating one more Avengers movie, like pre-Endgame timeline, with the original cast returning. Would you want that?
I mean, I would love... I think the world needs more ScarJo Black Widow, personally. I feel like the FloJo just was like misused after the Black Widow movie. Like there should have been more Florence Pugh. So it's just, you know, everybody else, I think it's played out. But at the same time, like you can tell more. This is what I was talking about earlier. You can tell more stories in the past if they fit what's already been there, right? Mm-hmm. As long as you write to the inevitable ending, you can go back and tell really great stories. That's why they did Star Wars prequels. That's why they can do Star Wars Rebels and then do Ahsoka later on. Like, you can have that grand plan. It doesn't have to be sequentially going forward.
Well, so, Deadpool's doing that. They're making a movie with Wolverine, but it's going to be before Logan. So it still fits the timeline.
Exactly. And I think that's really what we need to focus on is just, like, where does it make sense to stick in new content? Like, even the Black Widow movie itself was good, but then... like take stuff from Black Widow's movie and then you can continue on up until the point of Endgame because you could still build all of that out depending on how much, you know, time frame there was between Black Widow and Endgame. I have no problem with this idea. You have to be careful of who you're going to use in these roles again, right? We don't need more Iron Man. Like Iron Man had a great going out party. Like Iron Man shouldn't come back, but you could definitely have like Captain America show up or you could have, you know, something from Wakanda show up, not necessarily Black Panther, but, you know, tied into it.
Well, it'd be pretty hard for Black Panther.
Well, yeah. Well, if you were to go backwards.
I mean, it's a guy in a suit. They can do AI for his voice, which would be a problem. But I'm kind of on either side of this in the sense of I don't really need it. I can see how it would benefit it. It also feels like a way to cash in on something that worked now that everything that they've been doing doesn't work anymore. Mm-hmm. And that makes me feel manipulated and I don't want to deal with that.
That's what they've been doing for like a decade. I mean, Endgame was completely manipulating nostalgia all the way across the board. The entire thing was nostalgia and fandom. No Way Home. What do you think that was? It was manipulating. Don't get me wrong. Worked on me. I was a sucker. I'm like, oh, you got me. You got me. And if they did something like this, it would be the same kind of idea. It would be, you know, manipulating our feelings about those characters, bringing it back to like and reinfusing our love for that world. That's why I'm not against it, because those movies made me feel something. These newer movies don't make me feel anything. I feel dead inside when I watch them.
Well, like, the fear is, are those our characters? Is this a multiverse play where we're seeing different versions of these characters in a different multiverse?
Mm-hmm.
I don't want that. I want.
You'd be able to tell, though.
I'm so tired of the multiverse. Shut up.
But that's where they are right now. I'm done with the multiverse.
I know, and it sucks.
It sucks.
Can we agree?
It's not great.
Multiverse sucks. We're all tired. We get the joke, man. It's been hammered to death. Okay, visual effects. You were talking about visual effects, Troy. John, you are an artist, so I'm curious, like, where you stand on this. So, visual effects artists have been so burned out. This is the last thing that was in that Marvel piece. That they unanimously voted to unionize to protect themselves from Marvel's excessive practices. So what was happening was they were getting so down to the wire. These special effects artists were working so hard, so quick, so fast that they, you know, they're just basically churning out product and they never get a break. And it's just not fair to them. So they unanimously voted to unionize. What do you say to this, John? Do you think
I say good for them, because I was looking over a bunch of different articles in history on what happened with different VFX artists. And for a little while there, you might have noticed there were a couple of your friends who might have put up as far as their avatars on different social media platforms that they had just a green screen essentially as their avatar. And that was them speaking out for visual effects artists or people in the visual effects industry. There's a multi-layered reason as to why this is important. One, and I think this is actually more important than the other, than the rest of it. But with the rise of AI, there needs to be an organization fighting against making AI something that's copyrightable. Because once you're able to make it copyrightable, then you can actually sell AI. And then you officially put artists out of business by being able to do something like that. The other part of it is that, yes, you'll have an organization fighting for people to be able to have lives and have a good working wages and not to be treated poorly for trying to protect themselves or protect their own health for working a lot of movies. I give Seth Rogen some crap on this one because, well, I give him crap on a lot of stuff, let's face it. But I give him crap on this one because back a few years ago when he was making Sausage Party, there was a whole series of stories that came out that VFX artists that were working on that movie, not only were they working 24-hour shifts, but if they weren't willing to work 24-hour shifts, they would then get fired. Not necessarily Seth Rogen's fault. It's more of the visual effects company's fault for doing this, but it is a problem. Everyone treats artists as if they should feel fortunate for having the jobs that they have, and it's not something that we should feel fortunate for, because you can't grind us down to the stone because we are lucky to be able to draw and paint for you guys. So there's that. I just lost my other spot, my other thought, my last and final thought on this.
It's great. Okay to take a break from thinking.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're not getting the results that you need by talking to your employer, then I'm all for doing what you need to do to protect yourself. And so good for them. Obviously, the conditions had to have been pretty substantial for them to have a unanimous vote. And I think we've kind of heard about these stories over the years of how exhausted and burned out and with the constant changes and different direction and shorter deadlines and how quick they're trying to churn stuff out and mm-hmm. how many properties they're working on. Like it was only a matter of time until this happened, but it does make me wonder, did they do all of this kind of for nothing now? Because if they're going to significantly decrease budget for these movies, these properties, they're probably going to have less need. I don't want to say less need for the artists, but they may rely on them a little bit less.
And that's fine. Look at movies like The Flash. That movie, the visual effects on that movie were the worst kind of hot garbage. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of different Marvel movies and Marvel TV shows where we can say the same thing. And the whole reason why this is important is that we as viewers sit there and start looking at these visual effects and we start noticing that there's a step backwards happening in visual effects when we should be seeing nothing but leaps and bounds forward. But because you are crushing the souls and the abilities of the people who are putting all this out there for you, now it's starting to look like step backwards where worst case scenario, we're back to The Mummy Returns and The Rock's freaking scorpion thing and looks terrible. But it looks like what we're getting now.
The scorpion thing.
Yeah. Like MODOK. Terrible.
Terrible. Terrible.
terrible.
I mean, the thing here is that the union is still, I think, needed. So I think this is great that they, you know, unanimously voted this way. So even if the budgets are reduced, what's going to happen then is that VFX artists are going to get laid off, and it's going to be less people to do the same amount of work. Mm-hmm. Because even though there's like less money for it, they're still going to demand better work for the lower price. And it's just the way that corporations are even going these days with the way inflation's been going. So really, it's kind of how all people are getting squeezed, and especially going to happen to the VFX people.
Well, you know what? There are some effects that are done by the actors themselves. And the main one in the world that does that is Tom Cruise. So I'm going to segue by telling you to bring home Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 with Mr. Tom Cruise. It's on 4K UHD disc and digital right now. Tom Cruise stars in the film critics are calling the biggest and best action movie of the year. We concur. Fantastic film. Fantastic film. And you can buy Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 on 4K UHD disc and digital today. You can go behind the scenes with a bunch of incredible bonus content. It's available wherever you can buy Blu-ray. And it's rated PG-13 from Paramount Pictures. If you haven't seen it yet, go watch this freaking movie. It's amazing. Okay, we're going to go into some other movies. Some reviews of films that we've seen. One is It's a Wonderful Knife, which arrives in theaters November 10th before On Demand and eventually Shudder at a later date. Amanda, you and I both saw this.
Yeah, so after saving her town from a psychotic killer, as we all do, Winnie's life is less than wonderful. When she wishes she'd never been born, she finds herself in a nightmare parallel universe where without her, things could be much, much worse. You know, I saw an episode of Buffy that did this, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, true.
It just kind of felt like I was rewatching that. But we've got Joel McHale and Justin Long, and it stars Jane Widdup. Is there anyone that was a particular standout for you?
Jane Widdup is the lead. I thought she was a solid lead. Joel McHale stood out for sure because Joel McHale is always good. Catherine Isabel from Ginger Snaps was in this as the wild aunt. She's fun. And
I loved seeing that.
Yeah. And Jess McLeod as Bernie. She's kind of the co-star as the movie goes. I really enjoy her. She was a wonderful talent. But overall, nobody really like popped and said, this it makes the movie fantastic cast-wise. What about you?
Yeah, I would probably echo everything that you just said. I mean, I will say I gotta give Justin Long credit for the fact that he was willing to do whatever he did to his teeth, because he had really strong Choppers. God, what is his name? What's his name from National Lampoon?
Chevy Chase?
Chevy Chase. He had Chevy Chase teeth going on.
Yeah, that was weird.
It was weird, and his personality was weird, but it reminded me of how weird the mayor was in like The Grinch.
Sure.
And that's kind of a beloved character too. Like, some people just really like weird off the wall characters. You know, especially when it's this type of dynamic for a character. So
yeah.
I don't know. I gotta give him credit for being willing to do that with his career.
He was, yeah, I give him credit, but I gotta tell you, that was probably the biggest hindrance of the movie for me.
It was not enjoyable.
Like, it just,
yeah,
it was over the top. It was ridiculous. Everybody else felt like they were trying to be in the movie they were in. And I guess that's where I come to the tone, right? This is very much trying for the same tone as Freaky and Totally Killer, you know, very horror, but funny at the same time. And it never finds a rhythm. It's all over the place. And that's probably my biggest struggle with it. What about you?
Yeah, I think that the concept, although, you know, fairly generic, is still a solid one, especially as you learn some more of the details in the story. I will say, regardless of the movie, if there is one thing that will get me to watch something, it's a really clever title. Mm-hmm. And I think the title is phenomenal.
That's a great title. Yeah.
It is really, really good. And the concept and the execution was decent, but I agree. There was definitely something that I can't pinpoint exactly what it was other than Justin Long, where I was just like, something in me is like disconnected with this.
Here's the thing. Michael Kennedy wrote this, right? And he wrote Freaky. Same guy wrote both movies. Freaky, I think, captures the tone very, very well. And I think here, maybe it's director Tyler McIntyre, I don't know. But for whatever reason, I just feel like it can't find the footing for what kind of movie it wants to be. There's so many points where I think this could be right in my wheelhouse. I really love the killer's look. It's basically an angel with kind of a pale face. I really dug the look of the killer. I really dug the fact that we know who the killer is from the first opening minutes. It's not a matter of a whodunit. It's more of a matter of what happens because he done it, if he gets away with it kind of thing. And that part was fascinating to me. It's just, for whatever reason, it just can't find a steady rhythm and a steady tone for me to latch onto and have a wild time. There's lots of stuff I enjoyed, lots of stuff I had fun with. The kills are pretty fun. And again, I really dug the killer's look. But overall, it's just kind of all over the place, it felt like to me.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I wondered myself if there was some sort of a disconnect between our director and writer here, because Tyler has written before. So I almost wondered, he's actually wrote the Five Nights at Freddy's, which is pretty popular right now. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if it was his script and his direction tied together, if this would have been executed differently, or if Michael Kennedy, you know, would have been the writer and director, that type of thing, because it did feel like there was some level of disjointness, or where there was like a disconnect between what the movie wanted to be and its continual tonal shifts.
I think he just did the story for Five Nights at Freddy's. I don't think he did the
screenplay. He did, yeah.
Maybe that's where the switches came in. I don't know, but there's definitely a disconnect. And based on what I saw with Freaky, I gotta imagine it's gotta be the direction, because that script felt perfectly balanced in tone. Like that's a really fun horror comedy. Freaky is. This is an enjoyable enough watch. Like I didn't dislike it. It just could have been so much more, is the way that I would word it.
So if the full price of admission were $10, what are you giving It's a Wonderful Knife?
I'm giving it a 10 for title and a 5 for actual movie. What about you?
I would concur with that.
All right. Well, Marsh King's Daughter also came out. Very, very small release. It'll probably be on demand very soon. But John?
So you have Helena, who must confront buried past when her estranged father breaks out of prison. Before she was born, the Marsh King abducted her mother and she spent her childhood in captivity. Now convinced that he will try to take her daughter away from her, Helena sets out to outmaneuver the man that taught her everything that she knows about surviving in the wilderness. Aaron, this is being described as a psychological thriller with some picturesque backgrounds and marshes in it. What stood out to you when watching this?
Well, number one, best performance by Daisy Ridley yet, I would say. For sure. She plays Helena and she's wonderful. Brooklyn Prince is in this, is the younger version of her. She is a wonderful young actress. She's been in a lot of things that people have seen, and especially like the Florida Project. She was in Cocaine Bear. Remember, Dee Dee? So yeah, she's wonderful as well. But mm-hmm. Daisy Ridley is Helena as an adult, and her father is Ben Mendelsohn. You know, he plays Jacob. And in her mind, she thought her dad was a loving man. He was a loving guy. She had no idea that her dad was a psychopath. And then he ends up going to jail and breaking out. And she has to wrestle with the idea that this is still her dad. She still loves her dad. But in the same token, is he insane? Like, obviously he's a monster, but she doesn't realize what a monster he is. So what really stood out for me is Daisy Ridley. Just, she has to run the gamut of emotions throughout the film. It's really more of a character piece than I would call it a psychological thriller. It's really about her coming to terms with her past and learning to accept who she is, what her father is, and what she needs to do about it.
All right. Very cool. So, yeah, you mentioned Daisy Ridley is standing out, and it does have Ben Mendelsohn and Garrett Hudlin in it as well.
Garrett Hudlin is barely in it. I wouldn't even really mention him. He's the husband, and he's a real shitty husband, as far as I'm concerned. Like, because she doesn't tell him anything about her situation. And of course, once he finds out, he's very mad about it. He's really kind of a dick. And he's only in the movie for like 5 minutes. So it's really not that beneficial.
Oh, well, that seems like that's not enough use for him. Okay, so the director, Neil Berger, is known for a few things. He's done The Illusionist, Limitless, Billions, The Upside, just to name a few of the things he's done. Is there anything about his way of directing that carries over from film to film that you notice, or what do you think that he does well here?
I think what he does well here are wide shots. Nothing really stands out in terms of tension or tone. It's well shot, and it's well executed, well paced, and everything else. I think it's a slow burn thriller, but some of the cinemascapes and some of the landscapes are they're beautifully shot. So those stand out. But I wouldn't say that there's anything in particular that really wowed me.
And if $10 was full price of admission, what would you give The Marsh King's Daughter?
I give it $7.
Very cool.
Yeah, I definitely recommend it. Now let's go to our From the Outset In topic. All right. Well, in the last couple of weeks, we've lost several celebrities, such as Richard Mall and, of course, Matthew Perry. And could it be any sadder? So what we're going to talk about is how deaths can affect fans, because the world seems to have lost their minds over Matthew Perry in particular, almost as if they lost a member of their family. So I want to have an open discussion. Like, why do we seem to really struggle with celebrity deaths, Amanda?
We obviously connect to them in some way. You know, those people, maybe they were part of our childhood and were part of every movie that we saw growing up, or they played a role that changed our life and that we clenched onto. There's some sort of emotional connection that we have to these people, usually because of the characters they play or the music they write and perform, or whatever it may be. So I think that's where it comes from, is just that. I mean, I've had that connection even with like the fake characters, where I'm like, you get me. And then that person who's tied to that role is now synonymous with the character, right? And so
you've had that connection with a character?
I totally have.
Yeah.
Where I get like, where I'm like devastated when they die. Absolutely. I watched 19 seasons of Grey's Anatomy. Come on.
That's happened to me reading a book.
Yeah. It's that connection that you can develop. And for others, sometimes it's just because that person was kind of like a role model for them, because they were so cool growing up, or they did the things that you want to do, or whatever it may be. So you have some attachment to them, and that's where it comes from.
Matt, I don't agree with the Grey's Anatomy angle. I mean, I've watched the same amount as you have. I haven't been really connected to them, but A Million Little Things.
007.
True.
Okay. True. That's what I thought. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, A Million Little Things. I was definitely like, oh my God, you get that character feel. But you know, celebrity deaths for me, it's interesting, because like, I remember the fond times of like Friends or other properties that have been on for a long period of time. And it's like, oh, that's kind of sad that person's gone. You know, but it doesn't, like, I'm not losing sleep over it, I guess. Maybe I'm heartless, but I've also had a weird thing. You can ask my wife this. Like, I have a weird thing about death. Like, once death happens, it's like, okay, you know, they were here, now they're gone. Because I don't really feel like they're gone, right? Because
Jesus, man.
Well, because, like, I believe in, like, spirit energy, right? So even though their physical presence is no longer here, like, their spirit is still here. And if I want to go hang out with Matthew Perry, I can go pop on Friends at any time and hang out with Matthew Perry. So, like, I don't think that the death is that, like, tragic for me specifically, in the way some people have felt, like, you know, tragic to it. It's just a different way of looking at the experience. Like, I don't ever think, you know, we'll never get new Robin Williams stuff, but I can always go visit Robin Williams again. I think that's kind of the different take I have on it.
Yeah, I respect both those takes. I don't know. I'm in the camp of, there's certain people who I've built a connection with, and once they pass, it sort of feels like a piece of my personality has gone with them, you know, something that I grew up with and I identified with so much and that person created it. They put it out there in the world. I absorbed it. And now, you know, maybe I feel responsible for whatever it is that I gleaned onto from them at that point. And it doesn't happen all that often, but there are some people who do seep through. Richard Mull recently was one that really got to me because I loved Bull and I loved what he did on that show. And, which is Night Court and everything about that. I've been quietly hoping that he would show up on the new Night Court. But he obviously isn't.
No, now it'd be weird if he showed up now.
Right.
Harry Anderson hit me more on that in terms of that show and Marky Post. And I mean, just like, God, one after, I'm just surprised John Larroquette's still kicking at this point. I think it's just because for me, it has to be really shocking to really impact me. And it also, because Richard Mull, to me, I mean, he's 80 years old. That's not a huge shock. It didn't really take me aback. And plus, he hasn't been very active in the last many years. The reason why I think people get so attached to celebrities as opposed to anything else is you see them more. I see them more than I see people I, you know, care about. I watch Kurt Russell far more than I see many of my extended family. You know, I Clint Eastwood, I feel like I've spent more hours with him than I have most of my uncles.
Harrison Ford,
same thing. I mean, there's just so many of them that I just spent so much time with. The ones that really hit me the most, though, are the unexpected ones. John Ritter, you know, you wouldn't think that would really somebody on their ass, but that one just knocked me on my ass because he was a guy that I admired and loved, and he's going to be here forever. He's kind of like everybody's dad, you know, kind of thing. And then he was just gone. Heath Ledger, he was just coming up. River Phoenix. Oh my God. I remember that one really punched me in the stomach. Cause I'm like, River Phoenix, he's so young. And you know, that's just showing that no matter how much money you have and how pretty you are and how much fame you have, like you can't beat death. You know, you can't cheat death. Chris Farley didn't surprise me as much. You know, he didn't exactly have the healthiest lifestyle. There's something about spending week in, week out or tons of hours watching someone that they become like family to you. They become like people to you. Sometimes a little unhealthily. I feel like sometimes, you know, you hear people like they've just destroyed over a celebrity's death. And I'm like, whoa, easy. You know, this is where I lean more toward Troy. I'm like, that's destroy is a little strong. You know, you shouldn't be inconsolable over a celebrity. I don't think so. But other people have a stronger connection because some people, like there's a lot of people that are lonely or that don't have many people in their lives. Maybe they've had tragedies. Maybe they've had struggles. And so the joy that they get comes from that television or comes from that movie screen. And those people bring them joy. So to them, they are just like their mom, their sister, their brother. They bring them comfort.
I also think it depends on what time of your life that you've spent time with these people, right? Like we grew up with, you know, Kurt Russell's and Harrison Ford's, but I mean, most recently Pee Wee Herman, right? Pee Wee Herman was huge in the way that our lives were developed from 86 to 91 for people, you know, Aaron and my age, and even John's. Right. Like when Paul Rubens ends up going, you know, the way of the dodo in earlier this year, it's just kind of like, oh, man, like you reflect on all of the things that we do today that come from, you know, Pee Wee's Big Adventure and Pee Wee's Playhouse. You know, today's secret word is. And it's like that's the stuff that I think that hits you. It's like all of the nomenclature and taglines and funny things that you end up saying, you know, really connects you to the human being. It's those things that you get that kind of like sadness and nostalgia for versus just, you know, the fact that the person themselves is gone.
Well, sometimes it's the person. I mean, look at all the musicians and people are just like destroyed when a musician that they're used to hearing their voice all the time, they listen to for years and they OD or something like that, or they die young or they whatever, that hits them just the same way. I mean, people, I think that people just become close to entertainment. Maybe they don't have strong personal relationships, and that's a strong personal relationship for them. Matthew Perry is, do you guys know anybody that's really having a hard time with the Matthew Perry situation?
No, I don't I don't know anybody who's having a hard time with it. I am finding that everyone is everyone and their mother is sharing clips from that show. So now I feel like I've watched more Friends since he's passed than I ever did before.
Same. Yeah, agreed. I never watched Friends. That's the sad part. I like Matthew Perry in everything but Friends. I just didn't like Friends.
I actually really like Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip.
There was this quote that I had read, and it was a statement that he had made, and I don't know when he made it, but he was talking about, like, when he passes away, he knows everything is going to be about Friends. He knew that, you know, that's what would be discussed, and that was fine because it was a big part of his life. But he went on to talk about, like, I really hope that at some point people will also talk about the good things that I did to try to help other people and the organization that he built to help those who were also struggling with recovery. And I think that that was what impacted me the most about his death, was once I saw that and then I looked all around and saw everyone talking about Friends and him as a character and not as much about him as a person. And I was like, that's kind of devastating to think about. I mean, he still had an impact, and that's still amazing and incredible and something that should be talked about. But I do think it's, I don't know, when somebody dedicates a part of their life to doing something to better the humans around them, doing everything they can, even when they can barely, you know, hold it together for themselves sometimes, mm-hmm. like that's the kind of stuff that I hope we continue talking about for him.
Much more that than, what killed him? I don't care. I don't care. Somebody passed away. They died. It's why we have to dive into, so what specifically, like, was he on anything? Was he doing this? Was he down there? I don't care. None of that matters. And I don't understand why people get so obsessed with that. Like, you just have to know. Why do you have to know? Are you in the insurance policy? So weird.
I do think that at some point, as you get older and you experience more of these celebrity losses, a lot of them do come down to drugs and overdose. And so I don't know if that's, people become desensitized to it and then they're like, oh, it was just an overdose type of thing versus, you know, oh, he tragically drowned, that type of thing. Because when I look at my list of the celebrities who've impacted me the most, like their deaths, I go through what was their cause of death, how did they die, you know, because if it's old age, it's sad, but it's not going to destroy me. Like Betty White was really, really sad that that Earth lost that human being, because she was such a joy and ray of sunshine and funny and all of that that she did for everyone. But most like, at least she lived like a really good long life. But when it comes to people who you had hoped wouldn't succumb to that disease of drugs or alcohol addiction, it's like, that's really devastating. That makes it harder for me sometimes.
The one that hits me the most like that is Robin Williams, because he succumbed to a different kind of disease. And that one just hurts me because he was always such a source of joy and insight in my life that I really appreciated having him around and seeing him out there in the world. But then to see how he went out and how we lost him was just heartbreaking to me. It just shined a light on how much pain he had to be living with, emotionally, physically, all of that, just to make that a choice.
Yeah, the suicide is definitely the toughest.
Yeah, similar to Steven, Twitch boss, right? Anybody that was a So You Think You Can Dance fan just knew how much Twitch was.
Oh,
like the smile, the light, the popping and locking. He was the heart of the show. And then when he hooks up with Allison and then ended up getting married and then having kids, and it's like, oh, this is like a So You Think You Can Dance, like, beautiful thing, right? This show's going to live forever.
Yeah.
And then he gets the gig working on the TV shows and the TV show circuit. And it's like, this guy's got it made. And then all of a sudden you find out he's just got crippling high anxiety depression, which caused him to commit suicide. And you just have to wonder how much depression doesn't get talked about enough in this situation.
That one hurt me too. That one surprised me how much of a punch to the gut it was, because here we had this guy who, granted, he didn't make it to superstardom or anything else like that.
I don't even know who he is. I have no idea who you guys are talking about.
He was one of the
The reality show?
Guys on, no. On Ellen is one of the main shows he did.
Yeah.
So he'd be like their DJ, and he was very incorporated into the show as the years went on and became a really good friend of Ellen. So you got to see him pretty much interact on every episode.
Right. And the thing that's funny is that he wasn't even a real DJ for the show. He was just acting like a DJ for the show because that's what they needed. Mm-hmm. He was somebody who showed up, did So You Think You Can Dance, won millions of people over, and just strictly off of his personality, the light that he had in front, that he kind of gave off, and everything else. And he slowly made it to a point where he was able to create a life, and not just any life, but a good life with him and his wife and his kids. And yet here we are, he's suffering from crippling mental illness. I don't know if illness is the right word for it, but just...
It's depression. It is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his only way out. That one hurt me. It just hurt me because of like how much he had accomplished and what he could accomplish if he just kept pushing. But yet he couldn't do that because of that. That one hurt me.
And it feels like so often the ones who are the light in other people's lives have so much darkness in theirs, and... It doesn't always show. Like, you look at him and you look at Robin Williams and you're like, wow, I would have never expected. I mean, that's pretty much what you heard for, well, years, I think, after Robin Williams, is I wouldn't have expected it. Because you look at him and you look at what he was able to do for others in bringing them joy and happiness. And the same with Twitch. Like, that's just what they were able to do for others. And that's the part that makes it sadder for me too, is like when they're able to do so much for other people's lives, and it's like, should we have done more for them?
are there any other ones that you can think of that really impacted you, that we felt like you lost the feeling? Aaliyah, when she died, that one really punched me in the stomach a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she was just rising. She was becoming movie star. She was already a successful singer, and then her plane crashed, and that's it. Tragic. Very tragic.
Alan Rickman was another one that hurt me.
Still does.
Both of those.
Yeah.
Both of those still break my heart.
Paul Walker hit me harder than I thought he would. You know?
I think the movies had a lot to do with that, too. Like,
well, duh.
I mean, like, the timing, though, because, like, we were building up to, like, that's when it was starting to become regular that, like, every...
Yeah, I was going
to
see him every year. I was going to see him every year, and he was growing on me. Yeah. I'm like, you know what? He is kind of the lifeblood of this series. You really find out how much after he's gone.
Yeah, that's sad. I didn't know I needed a guy running around going, hey, brah, but I do.
The way that I sobbed in the movie theater when they did his send off. Oh, and that song.
Yeah.
Never fails to get you.
But they brought him back as an angel, so it's all good.
Hmm.
Leonard Nimoy is the one that really was like, you grew up watching Star Trek, and just, especially for me, right, Aaron and everybody here knows I'm a robot, so I'm very much Vulcan in a lot of my upbringing. I can't wait to meet him in the 2060s. But the thing that Leonard Nimoy, he was just a consummate actor and professional. And so when you get to watch him in his last years on Fringe and just like, wow, like watching Leonard Nimoy do like the beginning of his career and the end of his career and then have him go as Fringe is wrapping up. It's just, that one was hard.
Yeah. Speaking of Fringe, Chadwick Boseman is another one that shocked me. It's way too early for that young man.
I admired the hell out of him when I found out.
Absolutely.
How he died. Like, just what strength. What absolute strength he had.
Yeah, there's people have gone through, of course they have, and they've looked at interviews, and they looked at scenes with all the cast up on the screen, and they've watched him kind of like sit down and just close his eyes, and you've got other cast members from the movies watching him to make sure he's okay, and he's just closing his eyes, just trying to get himself through whatever it is that he's got to do for the movie, and he was incredible. Just such a powerful person to be able to continue to stand up and do that with everything that he was living through in that moment. Just amazing.
Heath Ledger is a huge one, right on the cusp of superstardom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people think he wasn't a megastar. He was known, but he wasn't like a box office
You know, but he was right at the
man.
He was going to hit the height of his career.
It makes you wonder, like,
right after.
What would he have done? You know, what could he have done? Mm-hmm. He proved what an actor he was with Brokeback Mountain and other stuff that he'd done. And he's so much more than just a pretty face. And then he drops the Joker and just transforms comic book movies overall. Not just villains, but comic book movies overall. It just transformed them. And now you look at Jack Nicholson, you're like, God, I thought that was cool. You look at Jared Leto and you're like, Jesus, like nobody's going to measure up to Heath Ledger anymore. I mean, it's so tragic. There's a lot of tragic actors out there.
Speaking of tragic, Anton Yelchin is another one. Just the way it happened and how young he was. And he was such an amazing actor, and I feel like I was getting so many great things out of him.
Pinned from a car, right? Isn't that what happened? Like,
yeah,
a car pinned
him? There was a mechanical failure on his Jeep, and he got pinned to a wall by it.
Oh, just like so wild to think about that whole scenario.
Yeah, I have a lot of similar way.
Who?
Bill Paxton, because he was literally had the aneurysm, and he's on the table having surgery. And then throws a clot or whatever in the middle of the surgery. So it's like he wasn't even planning on dying that day. And you just, you know, you realize like, you know, Bill wasn't like a well-known like A-lister Tom Cruise type thing. But so many movies, you know, Bill Paxton's right? He's just consummate, mm-hmm. you know. And it's one of those things where you grew up with him, right? From the pile of poo and Weird Science all the way up to the extreme, right? Riding the Twisters and into Big Love on HBO, so...
I just want to go back. He wasn't planning on dying that day. Who schedules that?
I was thinking that too. I was like, who's planning on dying? But to his point, it was low risk.
Has cancer or something that knows it's coming, you know. It's like.
Sure. I'm just like, who's planning it?
1 o'clock, I have that meeting. Other than senators.
I mean, Steve Irwin, he died unexpectedly, but that one doesn't really, I wouldn't file it under unexpected. I'm like, every single day he's dancing with the devil, essentially. And one time the devil bit back.
Don't. That's terrible. That sounds terrible.
It's true. I mean, he was constantly chancing death every day. Stingrays, it shows how dangerous stingrays are.
You know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I've saw something recently where this poor girl had a stingray barb through her shoulder. It was nuts.
Brittany Murphy, that's another one. She died super young. There's so many.
And there's so many layers to her death that just bother me. Was she murdered? Was she not? Mm-hmm. Who knows? You know, there's a lot of that to her death that really bothers me.
Like her husband or something, right? Like there's some speculation on that.
He's dead now too, so.
Oof, I'm not touching that one.
And of course, everybody misses Bob Barker.
Well, he was 1,000 years old. That one wasn't like shocking. It's just like, oh, Bob Barker finally died. I just assumed he was already dead.
Don't say that.
Like, well, I don't mean it like, hey, yeah, I was glad. I'm not glad. I'm just he worked, very old.
Like right up to the end. It's like, it's amazing to think like what
Bob
he was able
Barker
to
was
do.
Old before he was old.
Yeah. He was just an old guy. There's a lot of tragedy.
I have a lot of music related, like artists related deaths that got me. Mac Miller with how young he was, and he was really at the top of his career too. That was devastating. Tom Petty broke my heart into little tiny pieces and fractured everything.
That's lyrical.
Taylor Hawkins from Foo Fighters, when that happened, I felt the entire world like stop. I was like, what? How is this possible? Like, I don't know if you guys had any of those.
I'm not music hip. I don't know who most of these people are. So, sorry.
Okay. All right. Mac Miller, rapper. Tom Petty. Taylor Hawkins, the drummer for Foo Fighters. Dave Grohl's BFF. And the last one that had the most, out of anybody that's had the most impact on me, is Chester Bennington from Linkin Park. Because there are so many layers that go into it. It's the music that he created when I was younger that helped me survive the traumas and emotions that I was going through. So he was already like a connection point for me, an attachment. And then you listen to the album that he had literally just released with Linkin Park, and all of the songs are centered around this topic. And yet it feels like he's inspiring me to go on. And then he takes his life. And my entire world shattered
I'm sorry. That's tragic. Selena got me like that. I don't know if you remember Selena, the singer, when she was just horribly murdered right at the when she was right on the rise. I mean, I was starting to get into Spanish music, and then boom, gone.
I can't imagine why. Stop.
Now, this is before my wife. Thank you.
Oh, you never not like Latinas. You just
probably fair,
right?
Yeah, I figured that was his point. Was like Selena was beautiful, so. Made it real easy to want to get into a different genre of music, I'm sure.
Didn't hurt.
Yeah, I think the only one that was like really impactful like that would have been Steve Jobs. Like when we got news that Steve died, it was kind of like, you know, it's hard to look at someone like Steve where you know he didn't have a great personal life and he tried to do the best he could. You know, he was also this relentless, you know, CEO. But you know, when you think about celebrity, you see the celebrity side of it. So you remember him for the Stanford speech. You remember him for the iPhone. You remember him for the iPod. You remember him for the four quadrant, like relentless focus to just be better. And like when you lose a voice like that, I think that's hard for the world because you're like, who's going to step up and be that voice now?
And clearly nobody, because guess what? Every Apple upgrade seems to have the exact same camera. Meanwhile, Google Pixel is transforming things.
That's right.
Used to feel like, yeah, there's a good point there. Apple, when Steve Jobs was involved, had so much vision and potential. Like, don't get me wrong. I know Android had a lot of things that they were advanced on and superseded Apple on. But Apple also had a lot of really creative and inventive ideas and felt like they were constantly trying to improve and be better and do better and create more modernized and technologically advanced things for us.
Not anymore.
Now it's like, maybe we'll upgrade your camera, but like, guys,
they're too busy.
This one costs $300 more and it's the exact same otherwise.
Right. They're too busy looking at everything else going, hey, let's make one of those and then put our name on it.
Yeah, they were a leader.
Google's like making the best camera out there and charging the least amount of money for it.
I think that's what people don't remember about Steve is that they'll say like, oh, Apple was this innovative company. And it's like there were a lot of people that were innovating and engineers, Steve Wozniak and Johnny Ive and all those guys. Steve Jobs made a marketing company. Like he knew how to market. It's why they brought him into Pixar and why Pixar was so successful. You know, so it's not just the Apple part of Steve. It's the relentless focus on perfection and just being better in everything that we do. I think that's the part that we miss when people die like that.
Who's on your list that you're dreading when they pass away?
Well, it was going to be Harrison Ford, but now they can just make him look as young as they want. So even if he dies, he'll still be doing Indiana Jones movies in the 2050s.
Harrison Ford is the closest one for me just because there's nobody else at this point that has that sort of hold on me. You know, but Harrison Ford is always kind of like my buddy. He's kind of like that
cranky uncle.
Yeah. You know, and he's one of the few people from when I was young that are still around that I still see on a regular basis. Maybe Harrison Ford, maybe Mark Hamill. That's about it.
I don't know. I don't want to think about it.
Yeah, because as I'm thinking about names, I'm like, which one am I getting teared up on? And I just remembered that.
Which one of my kids do I want to see drown first?
Patrick Stewart just put out his memoir, came out, you know, in hardcover. I think it was earlier in October. And I think that's the one that's going to probably hurt the most.
I'm not convinced he's not an animatronic now.
Well, if you saw Picard season one, you know.
Harrison Ford will get me. Kurt Russell obviously will destroy me.
Obviously. These are obvious.
Yeah, Bruce Willis will destroy me. It's already been hard knowing what he's going through currently. I can't imagine once he actually passes away. Clint Eastwood will get me pretty hard, too. I've got a lot of love.
I thought about him, too.
For Clint Eastwood.
Arnold Schwarzenegger will be like watching a Titan fall.
I don't think I'll be Sly. Emotionally impacted.
Sly Stallone will get me.
Well, I just mean in the sense of he was and always has been larger than life. Even, you know,
literally.
Yeah. Like that's he's still just a giant. Whenever he walks in a room, he's hard to not look at. Whenever he's in a movie, he's hard to not pay attention to. So when he finally does go, it will be like watching a giant fall.
I tell you what. There are some people I think that when they pass away, there should be some kind of standing ovation of some sort, you know, across the world.
Meryl Streep.
Well, sure. But hang on. I think whenever Michael J. Fox goes, everybody needs to stand up and put their hand over their heart and say, God bless you for still fighting, like up until your dying day. Because that guy has been spending the rest of his life trying to do good.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And shine a light on something that's a horribly debilitating illness, you know, and I just, that's so admirable. So many other people would just give up, and he fights day in, day out.
Yeah, that one's going to hurt because the wife's side of the family is dealing with that exact illness. And it's like, I just wish that before he dies, they find the cure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a tough one.
And when Selma Hayek dies, I'm going to be very sad because I never got my shot.
You know? you wouldn't have it no matter how many years she lives.
Yeah, you never know until you try, Amanda. You just never know.
You're both going to be like 80 and you're going to be like, this is my chance.
I'll give it a go. All right. I think that's going to do it for this, because we're going to move into an interview with Daniel Knopf. It's the 20th anniversary of Carnival, his series that never received the finale it deserved. And Daniel also exec produced The Blacklist, which we're definitely going to touch on in this interview, as well as worked on Spartacus and Dracula, My Own Worst Enemy, a bunch of other stuff. And before I head into that, anything Amanda and John want to say in parting?
Go listen to Inspired by a True Story. If you're interested in movies, which clearly you are, if you've listened this far into our podcast here, and you like true crime, it is the meeting of the middle of those two topics.
Well, I mean, if she's going to say that, I'm just going to say, like, ditto.
I mean, you could put a little extra hoorah into it and motivate them.
Maybe I'll put a little extra. It's an awesome show. It's actually a labor of love that Aaron has put together and that we have graciously been a part of. So it's been a lot of fun so far to be able to do this and put together a show that fits into this genre that seems to be so popular for a lot of people. So if you are a fan of true crime, we do try to look at everything in a way that pays homage to the victims as well as pays homage to the truth behind the story, and it's a good sit, I think.
Yeah, and if you go back one episode from this episode in your feed, you'll actually get tricked, because we didn't have this podcast. We actually had Inspired by a True Story as a treat for all of you for Halloween. So. And it was probably one of the more gruesome ones. So do not eat your candy while you listen to that one, because it's pretty bad.
I've had friends.
The show is good. The crime is bad. The podcast is awesome. The crime is awful.
Thank you for the clarification.
I've had friends reach out to me and be like, you know, that episode, it's kind of messed up. And I'm like, I know, it did great, right?
Yeah, it's pretty dark. All right. Well, now let's go talk to Daniel Knopf. Troy and I talked to Mr. Daniel Knopf because Troy and I have interviewed him before on the Blacklist Exposed podcast. That's the other podcast that we're mentioning when we're talking to Daniel Knopf. So if you want to hear that past interview, it's at the Blacklist Exposed. You can go find it.
Blacklist Exposed, BLE 30, if you look for that episode, is the Daniel Knopf interview.
And he does give clarification on The Blacklist. Is Les Red who we think he is? What? Yeah, he gives that.
What?
So if you're watching The Blacklist and you're still not caught up, Christy Flores, because I know you listen and I know you're not caught up, don't listen to the interview yet.
And everybody else who beats up on Aaron, he told you so.
No, Troy told them so.
Yep.
Well, but they still beat up on you for it.
Yep. Yep.
Yep. It's weird. It's weird. I don't know how Troy is that much of a psychic, but here we are and none of us are richer.
Oh, just
so I feel like
ask him. Got to work on those. His ego will tell you how sure he is. All right. Well, here's Daniel Knopf. Thanks everybody for listening. Enjoy this interview. It's really good. It covers a whole gamut of things, including his new projects. So definitely check it out. Here's Daniel Knopf.
You guys look good, man.
Thanks, man.
You came out to set once, didn't you?
We did come out to set. Yeah. I'm glad you remember that.
Of course I remember. It was great to see you guys, you know.
Gosh, that was eight years ago.
The truth tellers.
do you remember the Blacklist interview? I don't know if you even remember, given the one you did where.
Oh yeah, I remember.
That became like legendary for our Blacklist podcast.
Oh really?
Oh yes, because I asked the question. You know, so is Red her mom? And You know, that was Troy's big claim to fame. And
you liked my big
trying to segue away from it.
Broad mental reservation. Oh, that's funny. How do you guys come up with this stuff?
And now I feel like a total idiot looking back on it when I go listen to myself. For sure.
I wouldn't, you know. You were dealing with a crafty Mensa member. Come on. I'm practically a supervillain.
I'm coming back to that. I just didn't know if you remember that interview or not.
But. Oh, I do. I do. I re-listened to it, and I said, okay, well, exactly what did I say? And it's like, I didn't lie. I never told a lie. I never said no. You know, but then again, it kind of sounded like no. You know. So,
to be fair, John Bokenkamp did that a lot too. So, you know, was dancing around the never saying no, but
never nearly as artfully as I did. I'm sorry.
Yeah. For people that are just tuning in, Daniel Knopf is the creator of HBO's Carnival. Nickelodeon's The Astronauts too, correct?
Yeah, did that one.
Not to mention been involved with numerous other properties as a writer, executive producer, projects like Dracula, My Own Worst Enemy. I'm a big Christian Slater fan. I'm not ashamed of it. And on and on and on. It has a book I encourage every wannabe writer to check out called Stupid Writer Tricks. It's on Amazon. You can get it right now. Now he's working on a special project called Gingerland, which we're going to be talking about very shortly. But at first, we obviously have to touch on a few things.
Housekeeping.
Yeah, housekeeping. There you go.
Yes.
As a writer, are you happy with the Writers Guild of America strike resolutions? Anything the average Joe doesn't understand?
No, I think they did much better than I think anybody expected. The length of the strike was brutal, and it ruined a lot of people financially. There's a lot of people who've lost their houses. Everybody I know. It's like you call somebody up and say, hey, can you spot me a couple grand? I got an insurance payment coming up. And they go, I was just about to call you.
Oh my God, that bad.
People are literally living out of their cars. And a lot of them have left Los Angeles because they just can't afford to be there. So it's having a devastating economic effect on the writer community in Los Angeles. But I really can't hold the WGA responsible for that. That was AFTRA, the rocket scientists over there, the Young Turks who have taken over the town. And, you know, it used to be that you'd be dealing with studio heads and producers, and they sent their kids to the same schools you sent your kids. The leadership class today are people who are all working out of Silicon Valley, and they aren't embedded in the community, and they don't care. And also most of them, you know, it's engineers. They're engineers, and they have no souls. You know, I think they just looked at it and did math. It's just, okay, well, if we can stretch this thing out, we're going to get a better deal. Just who cares if people get destroyed by it? And so they basically wouldn't meet with us and would put off negotiations, and they just sort of played the clock on the thing to horrendous effect. And so I'm not thrilled with the other side, but I am very thrilled with our guys. Our negotiating committee did a great job. Shout out to Nicole Yorkin, who I know, and she's a terrific person, and she was on that in that group, and she's like a bulldog. She's not going to let go. She did good. it was difficult. I'm just glad it's over. I hope the SAG strike ends as well, because I understand if it doesn't, in the next couple of weeks they might be shutting down rooms again. So, anyway, right on the heels of COVID, yay. You know,
hey, you know what? They might be resolved by the time people even hear this, you know?
So, I hope so.
Yeah, I hope so too.
From your lips to God's ears, Aaron.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes.
What's different from this one? Because you were also involved in the last one in 2008, right? Social media doesn't really exist. iPhone's just coming out. Do you feel social media and the voice of the people, or lack thereof, because everybody thinks they have a voice, do you think that played into these strikes differently than last time?
I think they're a factor, definitely, you know. But I, you know, this one was more vicious than the last one, you know. And there was no it just was a nasty thing. So
and I think too many people have the belief that because writers are in Hollywood, right? I think you see the glitz and the glamour, that they're all filthy rich and they're all like millionaires, and that's just not the case. Most writers are living check to check, honestly.
Most, I mean, if you got a staff job on a series, you're basically living, a good middle class, you know, what in the 70s or 80s would be considered a middle class lifestyle. You know, the house, the picket fence, the dog, the pool, you know, they're pretty. And there's some people are just, you know, when you're talking about most writers, because most writers now, they try to, they're staffing up with a lot of baby writers, people who've just come out. And so, you know, we're living out of apartments and stuff. And,
right.
And quite a few of them are living paycheck to paycheck. And this is especially true with like streaming shows. You know, a network show you can actually make a living on, but when you get into streaming shows or animation, it's not like a big money situation. Go ahead. We hear about the few guys that are just like, you know, titans, and they're worth millions, but most of us aren't.
Well, and I think it was a challenge too, right? Because as we've like learned through the years, right, 70s, 80s, 90s, you could grow up in the business as you're a writer. You could go to the set. You get to learn how to do some of the other things, become a producer, become an EP. You don't get that anymore with these streaming properties where you get writers that can actually grow with the business.
No, and there's a phenomenon that's very strange. I would watch these really, really high profile, incredibly valuable IPs, and they'd go, oh yeah, they'd announce who the new showrunner was, you know? And I'd go, who's that? And often it would be a person who was at best, like not even like a mid-level staff writer, would be elevated to being the showrunner of something that's like a household name of an IP. And I'd think, well, why, you know, or guys who are like playwrights, or they had a really cool short film, you know, at UCLA or NYU, you know, I mean, it's crazy stuff. And I think, why on earth didn't they even inquire about me? You know, I mean, I could do this in my sleep, you know, and then I'd watch these shows just 4 episodes in, just run out of gas and crash and burn, and, or they'd just be God awful. The Tolkien project over at Amazon was just awful. And the Pattern budget had to have been $20 million an episode.
If not more, I would say.
And you see, these things are all, I mean, they're just corpses littered all over the streaming landscape. And, you know, and I'm thinking, why wouldn't they put somebody in there who really knows what they're doing? And I finally decided, my theory is they want to bring people in who aren't going to give them any trouble, you know, and are going to, if they say jump, they'll say how high. And, people who are inexperienced and are really excited. Oh my God, I can't believe this ginormous leap.
Finally get a show.
I've got my own show, and I'm doing, you know, the Harry Potter series, you know, whatever, you know, some crazy big piece of IP. They are walking on eggshells. You know, they don't want to get replaced. And, you know, those aren't the kind of people you want. You want people who are going to challenge you. But they're just not that way. I mean, I think the old school guys understood that, yeah, writers are a pain in the ass, but that's part of the process, you know, and they're going to dig their heels in on some things if it's stupid. And I came into the game very late. I was in my mid 40s when I broke in. So, I was a health insurance broker. So I came from very much the real world, and I was a consumer for a much longer period of time than I was a creator. And I have a pretty good idea of why people watch TV. And, you know, they come home, they work a hard day's work, and they come home and they turn on the show, you know, fix themselves dinner and sit down. And it's like, I want to be engaged. I want to be transported, because, you know, most of the time we're not, you know, emotionally, you know, involved in our lives. It's usually just workaday stuff. And they want mm-hmm. people with high stakes and, you know, big, big moments and that they can identify with and that they can kind of live vicariously through these characters. And, you know, my job is to move them. And I have this talk with every single staff. The first day we sit down, it's like, okay, you know, there's going to be a couple million eyeballs on this thing and they're all going to be spending an hour with us. And if we don't do our best to at least distract them, you know, at best move them emotionally, then we've just basically burned up a million hours of human life force. You know, that's a heavy karmic toll. You know, I don't want to. So the most dangerous place on earth to be is between me and making sure that happens. And so when I get a note that I go, oh, well, that's going to really not work, you know, it's not going to work for the audience that I'm committed to, you know, entertaining and engaging. And I stand up and I go, no, I don't want to do that, you know. I had one guy threaten me over the phone from London. He said, if you don't make this change, just do it. Just do it. And I'm good. And I said, dude, unless you're ready to get on an airplane and fly over here and put a gun to the back of my head and threaten to blow my brains all over my laptop screen, it ain't happening. I'm not doing it. They don't want to deal with that. Okay. But that was
concerning if he did.
Well, it was a very, you know, it was a very toxic note and I wasn't sure. going to execute it. And they don't want guys like me. They want guys to go, oh, okay. So that's why you see so many shows. It's like, that doesn't make sense. Or why are they doing that? Or why don't they call mm-hmm. the police? Or why don't they get out of the house? I mean, just all these dumb things, you know, and it's like probably as a result of them getting a studio note, you know?
Enhance is my favorite.
my favorite is when we go in and we do ADR and it's like, oh, well, you need to have the guy go, it's all that shit, that shitty dialogue that happens when you're looking at the back of the actor's head or when the actor is off screen.
Oh, we forgot exposition here.
It's useless exposition. We drove over to your house, standing in the house. I mean, what bothers me about a lot of these notes you get is like, well, people might get confused and they might they're terrified that, you know, people have remotes and they should be because, you know, it's not like a movie. They can change channel mm-hmm. instantly. And they're going to be confused. And the minute they're confused, they're going to change the channel. And so we got to make sure they're not confused. So we baby talk them, you know, through, you know, everything. And, you know, what you're doing is, yeah, you're accommodating the 1% of the audience that are morons, but you're insulting the 99% that get it. And my feeling is, you know, is kind of like, you know, I feel like looking at them. I've never done this before, but I just feel like, okay, wait, but do you get it? Do you understand it? Oh, and if you did, and I have asked that question, okay? Mm-hmm. Yeah, but do you get it? Do you understand? Oh, yeah, of course, I understand it. Of course, but they might not. And it's who's they. I don't know who they are, number one. And number two, you're one of the stupidest people I've ever met in my life. You're like a sub moron. And if you get it, it's a pretty sure bet that there's people who are, you know, housed in facilities that get it. Yeah. So that's one observation I've ever made too.
Anyway. I don't think anybody's ever going to say that you hold back. That's for sure.
Well, no, I would never say that to an executive, but it's just, no, you know, they assume the audience is insanely stupid and they aren't, you know, they simply aren't. The audience is not stupid. And by the way, if they don't get something, if they're a little confused by something, the show goes on and they move on and they watch it. They're not going to go, you know, grab it. I don't understand why that guy's in that house, you know, or, mm-hmm. where those guys came from. Switch the channel. They just, there's a trust between the storytellers and the audience that, you know, if you don't understand it right now, you will understand it within the next, you know, 5 minutes. So,
or you got the goofballs like us that are like, hey, let's go ahead and talk about this thing for another hour afterwards for free. We'll explain it to you.
I got it. Yeah, you do. You overthink quite a lot, I think. You do some deep analysis.
You need some deep analysis.
But anyway,
I was gonna say, there we go. That's better. Like analysis, I think is a positive word.
Oh yeah, save,
you know,
my
a
life.
A lot of people don't know you also have written comics, including Iron Man and the Eternals.
We were just talking
about Marvel's struggles over the past year.
Disney's sort of like, you know, they haven't just killed the golden goose. They've kind of run it over with their car and then pissed all over it. they're trying to get too much product out. And it's a huge investment they made when they bought it. So it's like, oh, we got to make money now, you know? So let's have 5 shows on the air. And they don't, it's like, guys, don't you understand that just dilutes the brand? You know, you're just diluting the brand, and pretty soon you're going to fire hose it into where it means almost nothing. You know, Disney's doing that to their own brand at this point. You know, it used to mean something very specific. It had a specific niche, and now it doesn't mean that anymore. And it takes, I mean, it took 100 years to build that brand. It's only taken about 5 years to just, you know, sort of, damage it to the point where it is now, you know.
That's why they had to bring Iger back.
Well, the only thing Iger could do would be to film a thing where he goes on TV and he says, you know, to all of you who have spent their money at Disneyland and have bought our products and have felt safe to put their children unsupervised in a room to watch one of our shows for the past 50 years, we've betrayed you, and we're really sorry for doing it. We lost our way, and we're going to earn your trust back. Now, do you think Bob Iger's gonna take that? Nobody's gonna own up to the fact that people just don't trust the brand anymore with their kids. You know, that's a big problem for a company like Disney.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
So, you know, and earning that back would be a long, slow road, you know. I mean, it wasn't an overnight thing like Bud Light, you know, but they've really, really hurt their brand, you know.
What is the proper pacing then for something like MCU or Star Wars or any of these big IPs? Like, do you have the magic wand?
I think you could do one big movie and two series a year, maybe. And then there are events. You know, you got to keep it on the level of this is special. This is an event. Focus all of your creativity, your treasury, your everything on those things, and produce impeccable product. And you know, it's like the old days at Disney when they would release a movie, and then 5 years later they re-release it, and they take another bite of the apple. You know, that's a viable thing. You know, people, yeah, I can watch it on my TV. I can stream it if I want, but it's not the same as sitting in a theater and watching it. I mean, you look at the Wizard of Oz. I mean, the legs that thing had every year since 1939. I mean, it would be on TV and it was special. I just saw a wonderful documentary about, David Lynch and Oz and what an influence it's had on his, you know, creative life and it has on mine. Gingerland is very much an Ozian kind of thing. Yeah. So
I want to talk about Carnival because you can't not talk to Daniel Knopf and not mention Carnival.
Yes, I can.
Especially 20 years this year. I mean, that's quite an achievement. It's still in the zeitgeist. People still talk about it.
Yeah, and time goes by when you're not making money.
Yeah. <That's> Wasn't this originally a feature film? Any chance of like scratching the nostalgia itch and returning it to that form maybe or something? Or
going back to series? It can't work.
You don't think so?
I early in my writing journey, I started in on Carnival, and I tried to Tame the Beast, and what I ended up with was a 300-page screenplay, and I realized it's just and that was like
it's hefty,
you know. Yeah, and that was cutting it to the bone. I mean, that was removing all the flesh. It was just, and I realized, no, this is a big, this story is way too big for a 120-minute format, you know. And so, no, it was an ideal platform, HBO, for Carnival, and it's a serial, you know, and I've got a lot of story left. I mean, it took us, no, 24 episodes to tell the first book, and I've got two more books. So I owe the world 48 more episodes.
Do you think there's ever a chance? I mean, for people that might not know what Carnival, it's on, go watch it. It's on Max right now.
Yeah.
It's a show about magic, good, evil. It took place in the mid-30s, right? Mm-hmm. It was a wonderful, it's very mythological, right?
Yeah. There's quite a lot of occult mythology in it. Yeah.
Yes, it was wonderfully told. Very, very intriguing, interesting. There was some clever dynamics in it. Do you want to go back to it? And would you want to start over? Would you want a continuation? How would you go back to it? Because obviously it's been 20 years. The actors are all older.
First, an anecdote. When I was doing a Kickstarter for another project, and one of the prizes was, I don't know what it was. I had a bunch of things. And what the long short of it, they gave like $2,000 to this Kickstarter. And the guy wrote me a very, very sweet letter saying, you know, he did this for his wife, who's a huge fan, and he did this as a Christmas present. Mm-hmm. Now, this is, I don't know, four or five years after the show had gone off the air. And he said, would you write something? Would you write a little bit of like Carnival, you know? And so I just wrote this scene between Samson and Jonesy. It was a Christmas scene. It's they're in the cook tent. They're having a conversation about Christmas's past, and it was like putting on the most comfortable, ratty old sweater. You know, it's like I was able to just it was. So easy to write those characters after I hadn't done it in 5 years. And it was, and they have so much more to say. And we flirted. Scott Winant, who helped me develop it, said, Dan, let's go in and repitch it. And I said, well, the only repitch is a reboot. I mean, we'd have to start from the first episode, recast, redo everything because it's 20 years, man. Yeah, and he said, they'll never do that. You know, we would have to do Carnival 20 years later, you know, and pick it up as best we can. So we kind of came up with a version like that, that I wasn't really in love with, you know, and, and it had those tropes, you know, we got to have a female lead, you know, and so it's Samson's long lost daughter is management now. I mean, that kind of. And we went and we floated it past them, and they passed, and I'm really glad they passed. But in the meantime, my attorney's been in talks to get publishing rights. And so my plan right now, and it's beginning to look pretty good. We've got some traction there. And so my plan right now would be to release it in book form. It would be three very big, thick novels. A trilogy, one covering the years 1934, 35, and then, 39 and 40, and then 44 and 45. And
have you already written them? I mean, you already have,
they live inside my fevered brow, you know, but I'd have to break all the stories. And then the idea would be, okay, now these novels are extant. Now, HBO still owns the rights, you know, and now they can, you know, sort of do a George R.R. Martin thing with it. It's like now they got a set of novels and they got a you know, sort of a map to follow. And they might reboot it. So, I mean, that's, I think, where things stand now, you know.
I really think, I mean, the way everything is all about existing IP and brand recognition and nostalgia, I really think they could come back.
Dumbo feathers. Those are all Dumbo feathers. It's like, Whatever works, you know? It's like, no, we don't want your amazing, you know, you've done this massive amount of world building. I created this show called Sleepers that was H.P. Lovecraft mythology. It was really scary and kind of magnificent. It's a great playground. And you go in with that and it doesn't have, you know, it doesn't have an IP. And then they go, yeah, we're going to do a big passeroonie on that. But we've got this graphic novel we want to adapt that, you know, 80 people read, you know, it's like,
yeah,
great. Okay.
That's too bad.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
It really is too bad. There's so much good out there that doesn't exist already that we've come to love. I mean, you know, there's a lot of fantastical shows.
I'd love to do a contemporary version of Crime and Punishment. Would be, yeah.
Well, that'd be interesting.
To do that. Dostoevsky, he's no slouch. So, yeah.
Well, I hope you get to do that. I would love to see a reinvention of Carnival in some way. Modern, I agree. If you started it over, you'd probably have to go back to the drawing board because there's a lot of story packed into that.
I don't know how you continue it.
And
there were things we did that I wouldn't want to do again, you know, that weren't right.
Lessons learned.
Yeah, just bits and pieces. I mean, there were some episodes that were sort of laid down there and flopped around like a dying fish or something. There's some, and they were good in the first draft. So it's like, oh, well, you know, that what we just, sometimes it just doesn't come together. You know, the first script got kind of developed where we lost our way and we didn't have time to, you know, get it together before we started shooting it. You know, I mean, that happens on TV.
A lot of people don't seem to understand, you know, whenever a show gets canceled before it gets to finish the story that it's telling. Yeah. I think oftentimes they just assume that, well, why didn't they wrap it up? Why don't they get to finish them? Can you speak to that?
Well, we didn't know we were going to be canceled. So,
right. You hardly ever do, right?
Yeah. Yeah. They don't tell you, you know, nobody wants to give bad news, but I don't know if I would have been, I could have probably done a better job of it's kind of wrapped up in a weird way, but not satisfactorily. You know, it still screams this. There's more story here.
There's more coming. Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, you know, you look at the work of artists and there's these, you know, unfinished sculptures by Leonardo. And I mean, I'm not comparing myself to Leonardo, but there's these unfinished sculptures where they're just all you can see is the ghosts of this potential coming out of the marble. And the fact that it's not finished, the fact that it wasn't completed, lends it a certain kind of romantic gravitas that it otherwise wouldn't have. And I think there's a certain amount of that true about Carnival.
Well, and it's a shame that Sleepers didn't go through. I mean, because you think about, you already have the relationship with HBO from Carnival. HBO
does.
Have
you read it?
I've actually gone through and read Dream Cycle, which is based on, right, from Lovecraft back in the day.
Go to my site. Oh, yeah, everybody. Go to my site. It's easy to remember. Knauf.tv, KNAUF.tv. The pilot and the deck and everything, Sleepers, is in there. And just, it's pretty awesome stuff. I mean, I've got the pilots and decks for a whole bunch of shows that I've taken out that haven't gone for one reason or another. I had a shot at the Wolfman. And they went to pilot. The pilots are up. You can read them if you want. You know,
I think Sleepers would have been a great one because you have Lovecraft Country was already on HBO. They could do it like they do True Lies, where it becomes an anthology series and do different Lovecraft properties. Sleepers, would have been a great fit to fit in that medieval hole while waiting for House of the Dragon to come back.
Yeah, mine was sort of like Harry Potter with a heart on. It's all set in a Miskatonic like. It was like a Miskatonic type university, and it's a war between dimensions. I wrote this all before Stranger Things.
I'm sold on that description alone.
Yeah, but there's been other ones that haven't gone that yeah, they'd be great shows, and but you just don't turn the corner with them, you know. But they're all on NOFF TV if you want to read them. I mean, I don't know if there's another I don't know if there's anybody else that's that puts up his failures. I mean, I don't think there's any place you could go to see shows that were not made, the ones that didn't get picked great. Up. And so you go there, you click on Unseen, and there's probably, I don't know, a dozen or so scripts, the whole deal. One that is one of my favorite might-have-beens was Resident Evil. I was up for that. Constantine engaged me. I wrote them a bitchin' deck and Bible and a first episode. And when Netflix bought it, they said, "Oh yeah, we really love the property. We don't like any of the shit you did with it with NOFF." And it just out it went. But it was like, but then I watched the show and I'm going, "What?" like what? Oh my god! Yeah,
the show was
this
awful.
Could have been so awful. Good.
Oh. It was not good.
Yeah, yeah.
Anybody involved with that doesn't get to nitpick anybody else's take on it, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I haven't put that up. I should put that one up. Maybe
I don't. So you might get hit with some restraining orders on that one.
I've been waiting for them, but nobody's done that. So. Yeah.
So keep at it. There you go.
Worst case scenario, I just take it down. Yeah, you know, we own this property. We paid you to do it. You don't have the right to post it. It's like, yeah, okay. Well, I'll take it down.
Hey, speaking of properties that you're not supposed to talk about, but you do anyway. God bless you. I want to talk about The Blacklist because you were executive producer on that show for a long time. We obviously interviewed. We talked about that at the top.
Well, I was a co-exec longer than I was executive producer. So,
either way, you were involved.
Small correction. I was a writer on the show.
Yeah. You wrote the most infamous episode, Cape May, of the show, which kind of is a dive into the psychology of Raymond Reddington, who the character was. And you are the only one who's gone on the record in terms of who Raymond Reddington is, because everybody's so terrified to talk about it.
Well, there's some caveats to that.
Sure.
And remind me, just use the word caveat. No, give it to you. But I'd like to answer these things. Cape May was a very interesting episode in that I was at the end of my second season and my contract was about up. And nobody had approached me to talk about, renewing me on the show. So it was like, okay, I've been writing these episodes and rewriting these episodes and breaking these stories and doing all these things. And I really haven't written one for me, right? And so I came up with the concept of Cape May. And then John went upstairs and spent a week or so figuring out, you know, the breaking the story.
The creators, executive, John Bonkenkamp and
as
John
they, as yep. they do. And then they brought it down to me and they said, okay, here it is. Go ahead. And I looked at it, I read the story, and I went, nah, I'm not going to do this. I said, oh, no, this, what I had in mind was much better than this. I'm just going to do that. And my attitude was, my contract's up anyway. I got nothing to lose. And I've never really had an opportunity to write one of these things for me, you know? Mm-hmm. And we were really coming up quickly toward prep. So there wasn't a lot of time. And so I wrote this thing and it is the most subversive piece of writing I've ever done, only because of the platform it was on. You're doing it for a network procedural, which is a very conservative platform. And what I was writing was like a European art film, you know?
Very much so.
So I wrote this thing. I turned it in. They kind of freaked out, like, you didn't do what we wanted you to do. And then word came back from James, and he said, oh, this is magnificent. I want to do – this is great. He had no notes, you know, none, which is very unusual. And, our big director over there was just John. He said, I was going to do the finale, but I want to do this one. So it was like, you know, all the best hands were on deck with that show. And it pretty much was everything that I wrote undiluted. There wasn't any rewriting by John or John in it. And this is the way I sort of saw the show is, mm-hmm. you know, and so it was a crazy experience. Then they renewed my contract and they said, oh yeah, we want you to do another Cape May. And I think they were really kind of angry at me about Cape May.
Too much too early?
No, it was that I didn't what I did.
You didn't follow suit.
Because the thing is, once the star of the show and the network loved the script, by the way, and they pushed, mm-hmm. they submitted it for an Emmy, you know? So the network was on board, but the guys who were running the show weren't quite on board.
If I remember right, Daniel, I think they saw this as, the network actually intervened because there was a, you know, that was the Elizabeth fake death. And then it went right into this next scene. And they were like, no, we need Red to grieve a little bit. So even the network was like, we need something else to stick in here. So kudos to the network to actually give you that platform to put in your vision. Because that doesn't happen, that the network's going to say, hey, listen to this guy.
Well, they lie. They really love this. They love the episode. They love the script. I mean, I didn't, you know, I was no threat to them, but I think they did. I mean, in the third season, I was just put in a corner and, oh, do the speech for Red. And it was like, you're like a composer and you're forced to, you know, it's one thing whenever I'm a composer and writing on staff is like being a session musician, you know? But you know, if you're a session musician and they're sticking you in the corner and they're saying, here's a kazoo. You get to play the kazoo. It's not a fun situation. And that's why I departed. It wasn't a happy working situation. So
they're not always happy. But you had, Troy had this theory for a long time that Red was actually Liz's mom in the show.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, look, this is the last time I'm ever going to talk about this, but I'll be totally straight. The first day I came on the show, we're all gathered in the writer's room and John stood up and told us, okay, here's this thing. We're swearing you to secrecy. Do not discuss this. Do not reveal this. You know, Red is actually, you know, he's transgender. He used to be a woman and he's hiding in a male body. And we all went, oh, wow, that's kind of cool. Now, keep in mind, this is a long time ago. This is before transgenderism was like a bit. Now, if they'd done it, like if they'd actually done a big reveal, it would have felt like such a, you know, also ran. It would have felt like, so what?
Oh, you guys just did that. You pulled that out of your
bum. No, you did it because it's so popular now. Or it's, you know, you're so woke or some bullshit. Back then, though, it was truly, a remarkable turn of events for the main character.
Yeah, people forget the show's 10 years old.
And we said, well, have you run this past the network in the studio? I asked him. And they said, no. They had, and they'd kept it to themselves because they're afraid the studio, and the studio probably would go, absolutely not. No way. We're not going to allow that. I mean,
they don't want to step in those waters.
Keep in mind, those are my recollections. People probably have different recollections of that. And that was the state of, you know, things way back then. And I left the show in its fourth year, and it went on for 10 years. So lots of things could have changed in the meantime. Lots of decisions could have been made, but that was the conversation that took place on my first year, which was the second year of the show. It feels like they kind of did it at the end.
They did.
But they're very cryptic about it, you know?
What they did was at the end of season 8, when Liz is written off the show, essentially, they gave the reveal. It's all flashbacks, and they gave a very clever reveal in the final seconds of that season finale. And then they really never went back to it. So they never addressed it again directly. So then it was no longer this, who is Red Reddington? Because I think in the show's mind, we decided who we told you. In our way, we're not going back to this. We're not touching it again. And they never touched it again. Like, they really did. I mean, Troy, you correct me.
Yeah, the fans were the ones that are keeping it stoking the fire. And it's like the show had moved on.
They still kept stoking it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they just, but they would never say it outright. And I'm like, how can they in this environment come out and give that reveal directly? I just can't picture how a network could do that in this environment.
When I posted my little blip, there was like a huge hue and cry. And a lot
for context, for people that don't know, Daniel, wasn't nice enough to go on the record in our Facebook group, the Blacklist Facebook group, and said, nope, that's what happened. And of course, everybody started attacking you because that's what people do when they don't like the answer.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm used to that. I mean, I had people trying to get me fired on that show while I was on it. I mean, the fans are very passionate on that show. But I said, look, this is what I heard and this is what I knew. And so do with that. And then people start, oh yeah, well, first of all, who is this guy? You know, it's like, yeah. How would he know? You know, he's just a hoax and whatever. But it's like, I mean, geez, how much skin do you have in this game? Really? I kind of go, but the upshot was that, you know, I have to qualify it. This is in the second year of the show. It was discussed, and I wasn't present for years, you know, 5 through 10. And so many, many creative decisions could have been made in that time that I wasn't privy to. So this is a snapshot of a specific moment in my tenure on the show, and that's it. Beyond that, I can't say.
They didn't defer because it took many years before I really was on board. I mean, it wasn't that it didn't fit. It's just like, they're not going to do that. And then they did it. And I'm like, well, yep, they did that. And my biggest reservation, I had told John this before the final season directly, was all I care about is if that is the answer, you have to make it more than just he's hiding or she's hiding. Yeah. It can't be just, I'm just hiding. It has to be because that's naturally who I am as a person. Like, she always felt that she was better suited for that body. And otherwise, you're insulting a whole, you know, community, which they did. Well,
I don't know. But anyway, there it is.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that. Troy, anything you want to mention?
I'm just curious what you thought of the actual ending with Red facing off against the bull, or if you even saw the actual ending. If you had
I didn't watch it. I never watched the show after I was off the show. Yeah. I mean, I was kind of done with it.
You didn't miss much on that ending, let me tell you.
I mean, I barely watched the show when I was on the show.
Yeah.
I barely watch anything I'm on. It's like, because I'm watching it a million times in, you know, in various states, you know.
I get that.
Yep. I'll watch it when it premieres. I'll have a little party with some close friends and we'll watch it together. But I don't. You know, my show's on, you know. Carnival I watched. I watched that every week.
See, I think people just make the assumption that if you're on a show, you run a show, you write a show, whatever, you're watching it every week, you're having your own little Game of Thrones party at the house where everybody comes over just to celebrate your work and stuff. And I think it's the furthest from that.
You're exhausted. It's really hard work. You're doing 14-hour days, 6 days a week, you know, and it just eats you alive doing a show. I love doing it. I love running shows. I don't feel alive unless I am running a show, you know. And I miss it terribly. But, you know, I mean, I hope to do it again someday. The Astronauts was my – I ran Dracula, and that was fun. But the Astronauts was the only show I ran that I created besides Carnival, and that was fun. Amazing staff. I had a crew that was great. We were building spaceships. It was a lot of fun. Yeah. The kids were great. The parents, you know, I won't talk
their
about
parents,
their parents.
Right?
The parents were their parents. But, you know, it was a different kind of challenge. And it really, it was a really great experience. And it was a great show. I mean, I don't know if you guys have seen it, but we're nominated. I got nominated I got a WGA nomination. I got an Emmy nomination on that one. The show itself, the writing, the production values were unbelievable. we were spending a good amount of Nickelodeon did open up the purse on that one. And mm-hmm. And Imagine, you know, you want to get into a space project, you can't do better than Imagine. So it was it presented a lot of interesting challenges, but you know, it's a show that, and what I wanted to do and what my intention was is like, I remember almost every show I grew up with was a show that mom, dad, the kids could sit and watch together and enjoy. Sure. You know, that was the standard. I mean, you know, every single show on broadcast network TV back then was something we could all just sit down and actually enjoy. You know, whether you're watching The Fugitive or you're watching Batman, you know, some skewed more for the kids, but the parents could sit in and watch it too. And I said, I want to make one of those shows. You know, I want to do, you know, Andy Griffith. I want to do one of those shows.
Oh, and,
you know, and so
I'd whistle that song if I could whistle.
Yeah. And when we did The Astronauts, I had like really hard and fast rules. I said, look, first of all, it's five kids being shot into space. So we're doing a tightrope walk over a bubbling cauldron of cheese as it is. So I want the science to be correct. I want the look to be correct. I want it to feel mm-hmm. like a ship. We had ideas that by then, you know, the old Ridley Scott stuff where everything is, you know, form follows functions and everything's kind of boxy. You know, the living areas on the ship, on the Nostradamus were pretty slick. You know, slick. But I thought, no, this is a guy like Elon Musk, and that the cockpit is got a consumer vibe about it. You know, that, you know, lots of interesting kinds of textures like carbon fiber, and everything's a little mm-hmm. bit sleek, you know, but not Star Trek sleek. So we haven't spent much time.
The trailer was really cool. I didn't actually watch the show. It was more family geared, and obviously I'm old.
Yeah.
But I watched the trailer before we did this just so I could get it. And I'm like, wow, that actually looks really good. I would have watched it if I knew about it.
You could watch it and enjoy it. There were a couple things I did in the show. One was, there's not going to be any stupid parents. The grownups aren't dumb. They're the ones who are up in the stands while the kids are playing softball. The kids mm-hmm. are on the ship. So at the end of the day, the kids are going to make the decisions they feel they need to make to survive. And the other one was, I had this one episode where I sort of blew, I have this, you know, this really smart, plucky character, and she got him out of all kinds of, she just, you know, she was an astronaut's daughter, and she was really brave, and she was just, you know, she was like the hero. And I had an episode where they had to turn off a computer, and getting to the computer was really, really hard. I modeled that on when I owned a BMW motorcycle, and you had to take off the tank to get to the battery. But it was like the engineers had made it so that astronauts really can't get to the quantum computer because they don't want them to get there. And sure. So they have to work their way through it. And it's this really difficult track, and they get to it. And our hero is faced with a wall of obsidian with no control things on it, nothing, just this blank obsidian wall. And she just has this breakdown. Like, this isn't the way it's supposed to work. And what I was doing with that is, when we're children, we're told this huge lie. And that lie, and it's out of the, you know, your parents, God bless them, you know, is you, if you work hard enough and you really study and you do everything right, you can do anything. And that's simply not true. And it's usually sometime in our early 20s where that lie blows up on us. And we realize, you know what? I'm just not going to be a doctor because I'm no good at biology. I have no love for it. And I can't get it, you know? And you go, oh my God. Or there's just too many other people trying to do this, and many of them are better than I am. You know, and mm-hmm. I mean, that whole thing of, if you work hard enough, there is things, there, sometimes there's luck and talent, and those are operative in the world. And, you know, we don't always get, you know, what we want. We usually get the parking space next door to what we want, or maybe two spaces over from what we want. And I thought, you know, that was that moment in that where that was an existential sort of, okay, this is now, you're going to die. And she says, like, you know, I guess we're going to die now. And they, you know, the ship is getting colder and colder and they're running out of oxygen. And it's a kid's show. This is my kid's show.
Yeah, darker, darker kid's
segues,
show.
Segues. It's not, but there's one where they're chasing around a rubber, like, squid through the toilet system. So there's kid, not a kid, there's fun stuff in it too. But, I mean, it kind of brings me to
Gingerland?
Gingerland, definitely. Because that was different. That was a similar but different challenge. And that was, okay, I have a certain sensibility and I want to do a kid's children's thing that is as iconic or potentially iconic as, say, Frosty the Snowman or Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. I wanted to do a children's Christmas fantasy that could be enjoyed by adults, like all of Roald Dahl's stuff, you know.
And I should mention before you go, it's gingerland.substack.com, right? Gingerland.
Yeah, if you go to Gingerland book, you can actually, if you go to Google and you write Gingerland and Substack, it'll take you right there. There's a homepage that's one word, small case, gingerlandbook.com. It'll take you to everything. We've got the Substack. We've got the illustrations up. We've got the shop. We just opened up a shop of, you know, stuff, you know, Christmas stuff. But the main thing is the book, and the book is free. All you do is you put down your email. I own the list, literally own the list, and I'm not selling it to anybody ever. Because I hate spam personally. I loathe spam. So you're not going to get flooded with a bunch of crap in your email box because you signed up on Gingerland. So you give us your email. You'll get a newsletter once a week that'll basically be a new chapter. It'll be a new, you know, right now it won't be new chapters because all the chapters are up. The entire book is part 1 through 4. The entire book is up. The first 14 chapters you can read. The firewall comes in after chapter 14. And if you subscribe, it's like $5 a month, $4.95 or something. And you can read the book and, you know, you can cancel your subscribership after you finish the book, I guess, you know. And if you don't, you know, look, if you read 14 chapters, I think you're going to want to read the rest of the book. You know,
I think that's an interesting way to do this, by the way. What made you decide to take this model, I guess?
Dickens. Dickens. What's now suddenly for some reason become politically incorrect, but he's been my spirit animal on this when it comes to how to get it to land on eyeballs. It's a serial. Christmas Carol was published as a serial. And, so I knew I wanted to do it that way. And so Substack was, an interesting place. I mean, it's a good place to put it. There's a lot of great writers on Substack, not a lot of fiction, mostly journalists. But it was I like their agreement, their author agreements and so forth, you know, and so I thought, okay, I'm going to do it this way. I'm not going to throw it on this big, fat, ugly, dumb data pile that is now, you know, Kindle, you know, and I wanted people to go to someplace where they could read it, you know, chapter by chapter. And, not to preclude, what I'm saying is, look, if you go with an annual membership, we plan on doing a sort of a really nice book version, like physical book that would be an heirloom quality type of thing, you know, really nicely printed.
Be a big book.
Yeah, it's I think about 121 pages. You know,
it's not too bad then for a kid's book. It's pretty good
for a kid's chapter book, like old fashioned chapter books, and that's what. I mean, this is modeled on books like, Johnny Gruhl used to do these. This was a sort of an antique, but, you know, they'd do these things. And it'd be about, you know, that thick.
Yeah.
It'd be a child's chapter book, you know, things like the Hardy Boys and stuff like that. But the illustrated chapter books. And, And so I modeled it on that. It's an old school model. I created an author, PJ Hummel, who's my pseudonymous author of Gingerland. And it, the whole thing was, yeah, he wrote it in the 50s. He wrote it in 1952. And so, but it's, you know, like the astronauts, it takes some deep dives. You know, I mean, there's some scary parts in it. There's a part where they need to get information from the janitor at this hotel, and they sort of terrorize him. And you know, there's literally poetry in it. There's verse in it. There's a Christmas song, and there's like three songs, and then there was like a little bit was I did that Roald Dahl used to do really really well was build out a scene where people are speaking in verse. You know, mm-hmm. And so I had a little fun with that. But the story, it's three ginger kids. They live, you know, in the perfect world, and it's manufactured world, little gingerbread hotel, Gingerland Mountain House where everybody lives, and they skate and they snowshoe and they have snowball fights. And then it's Christmas is always just around the corner. Mm-hmm. And they fall through the butter brickle floor of a gazebo, and they end up falling into some packing material, and they dig their way out, and they're inside this huge place, and it's just like the Gingerland Mountain House, but it's Titanic. And they discover that their entire world is a holiday diorama under glass in a fading Adirondack hotel. And so their adventure is to try to get home. And, you know, there's a lot of dangerous things and there's some dangerous people out there. And then they finally do get back. But when they get back, they realize, you know what? This, you know, at least Holly, the character, the hero, is saying, I don't know how much longer I'm going to spend in here. I think I might be going to the big outside soon, you know? And it wasn't until I finished it, got through the last draft of it, and I thought, you know what, this is resonating. This is resonating, and I, you know, what did I really write here? You know, and I realized, oh, this is an allegory for the internet. Hmm. We create these worlds.
I could see that.
We create these worlds where we have muted or blocked anybody with an opinion that we don't agree with. We pile on people and cancel them, and we construct this world where everybody's just sort of like us, and we spend less and less time in the real world. And the internet is not a place where spiritual growth is possible, because spiritual growth, it requires friction. And people who do disagree with you and people who are different, and learning how to either deal with them or live with them. And what we don't, if we live too much of an online life, if we put too much of our time online, what we don't know is there's monsters outside that bubble, and they're watching. They're watching the choices we make when we go to, you know, purchase products, and who we like politically, who we stand behind, and you know, things they get to know us pretty well. And with AI, they can basically do a full profile on you that would be stunningly accurate. And their intentions are to exploit you at best and possibly to harm you. And that's kind of like what Gingerland's about. There's two very, very horrible people outside Gingerland in the real world that have their intention is to destroy Gingerland, literally take Gingerland and put it in, put it in a furnace, you know, throw it in an incinerator. And, you know, all the people in Gingerland have no idea, you know? And so it's, I guess a cautionary tale. And, but it doesn't, you know, it's not screaming that. It's not like that's not in there. You know, it's nowhere in the story. But to me, a story that touches you on a has to be touching you on a deeper level than you know. And that's kind of the thing I'm saying is, hey, you know what? You can't smell the flowers on the internet. You can't mm-hmm. hug anybody on the internet. You can't, you can't even, you know, you can, all you can do on the internet is talk. And talk is, you know, as a person who writes dialogue for a living, dialogue's the least important thing of a great script, you know? It's not about dialogue. Bad writers write clever dialogue. You know, everybody sounds the same. But what you want to do is you want to get emotions across with behavior. You know, they're the choices they make, you know, what they do in a given situation, not what they say, because what we say mm-hmm. is mostly lies. You know, until you get them, it's getting a character pressed into a corner where they have no alternative but to tell the truth. Like bad scene work is a man and a woman or two people in a relationship and one person saying, I can't be with you anymore. You know, I feel yeah, like, absolutely. You know, I don't love you anymore. That's bad. That's bad scene work. Scene work, great scene work is one person is in the kitchen and one person's in the in the living room, and the person in the kitchen's making a lot of noise and banging a lot of dishes, and the other person comes in and says, is there something wrong? And the first person says, no. And the other person says, no, obviously you're upset about something. I mean, do you want to talk about it? No, it's nothing. It's nothing. And the reason they're saying, no, it's nothing, isn't because they don't want to engage the person. It might be, but mostly it's because they feel stupid for feeling that way. They feel like they're going to feel dumb if they voice their you know, their problem. And then it goes back and forth until, you know, eventually somebody is forced to say, I don't love you anymore. And that's a process, you know, that's drama. That's really essential drama. And so that's where I like to go.
Or I want to love you and I don't feel safe telling you.
I went off on a wild tangent.
That's a lot of growth that people are doing these days, right? Is trying to figure out, like, how do I move forward? How do we even talk to each other anymore?
And that's not possible on the internet. You can't have a nuanced conversation not with anymore. Text. Nope. And when we're not on the internet, we're texting each other. I mean, it's like, can you imagine if Alexander Graham Bell had invented texting and we've spent the last like 100 years texting and then somebody invented a phone call? It would be like a phenomenon. It would be like, oh my God, I could finally just talk to people. But it's like, mm-hmm. it's so regressive, but it's so safe. You know, oh yeah, you know, Yeah. And so the thing is real life beats the living shit out of online life. And I think that's what the Sugar Plum kids find out in the course of Disneyland is real life is where the action is. And that, you know, underneath that beautiful, you know, cut glass cover, you know, and the crystal color cover in the display in the little fantasy land, that's where you go to die. The internet really is where we go to die emotionally and intellectually, frankly. So I think it's an important book. I mean, I think that's an important message, and I'd like to get it out there, you know? And it's told in a very entertaining way, you know?
I read to my kids all the time, and I love the books.
You can read this to your kids. There's not. Did you read this one?
I've been working my way through it. My kids are a little bit older now, but when my kids were younger – I mean, that is something that I took pride in, was sitting there with them every night and having that bond and that connection with them. And if the story is good, that I'm actually engaged in it as the parent, right? I'm doing the funny voices and I'm trying to pretend to be the characters, and that makes the kids more engaged. And that's a magical moment.
Charlie the Chocolate Factory.
Or the Notebook of Doom was one that I loved.
Oh, absolutely.
So it's like, if this is that kind of story again for parents of today's age, that's awesome.
Well, I always thought this would be something where it's four parts and it's like the 4 days, 4 nights before Christmas, you get together as a family and you read it aloud. It's written literally to be read aloud. It's very lyrical. The language is conducive to reading it out loud. And so I designed the book to be read out loud.
I love that.
Gingerland.substack.com. It's there now. It's really cool. I love the idea of the way you had your author's note set up. Gingerland is based on stories told to me by my grandmother, Dorothy Sandberg. And this book is not intended to be read by children, but to them by a parent or beloved adult. Something that, like we were just, you were just talking about, is a lost art that too many parents have abandoned for tablets.
Yeah. Well, and you can read it as just an adult and probably enjoy it.
You know? Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I love that you included that, because that's something I used to do with my kids, and I hope parents still do that to this day.
Yeah. I would encourage it, because they're not getting it at school.
Right.
Yeah.
No? Mm-mm. No.
Anyway.
Well, Troy, anything with Mr. Knopf before we
close out? No, I'm just glad that we've been able to hang out and be friends, Steph, eight years, and be able to bring you back into the fold and, you know, not have to talk about Blacklist only, and just love the fact that your career has been.
I've never left.
No, that's great.
I never left the fold. I've always been your fold, you know, Troy. Give me a break. You guys have really, you know, I mean, to me, the work you've done, and even though it's joyful work, you obviously love doing this. You wouldn't be good at it if you didn't love it. I had a fan on Carnival, and Beth. Why am I going blank on her name? I feel terrible. But these people who go the extra mile and make the experience fun, you know, and you guys really, I can't speak for the guys who created the Blacklist. You're such an important asset to the show, only because you help people enjoy it more, you know, and talk about it and invest more. This project is a very interesting project. Now, the Hollywood Outsiders, are you talking mm-hmm. about the people you're having on, or are you talking about yourselves? Is it sort of a play on the whole Hollywood insider thing?
We're on the outside looking in. Yeah, that's essentially what it boils down to.
Well, I'm going to be listening, you know?
Well, good. I hope you enjoy it. I started doing this like over a decade ago, and the whole reason, what, long before everyone had a podcast. And the idea was, I'm just tired of people that can't enjoy entertainment. You know, they're just finding everything to dislike about it, instead of, well, this is what the creator was going for. It isn't what I wanted. It isn't what it's not what I want.
Yeah.
This is their intent. Is it good for what they intended it to be?
Did they spike the mat? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's what it should be. And unfortunately, too many people are just looking for things to complain about, especially, God, it gets worse and worse every year.
You put something on and you think, wow, they're going to be pissed at this. And then not mm-hmm. a peep. Then you put something on that's like, you know, it's always this thing that, you know, it never even occurred to you that somebody would get, that this would be controversial, you know? And then you'll get this huge mass of crazy pants, this big delivery of a truckload of crazy pants. And I just, you know, I've given up on trying to anticipate what people are going to get pissed about. And we live in a world where people are rewarded for this, you know, fake outrage, you know, it's like, really, you're that mad about this? You know, I kind of throw in the people who go, yeah, you've ruined Indiana Jones for me. He's destroyed Indiana Jones. He destroyed this. And it's like, well, you can always watch the movie. They haven't changed the movie.
Change anything.
No. Philip Marlowe used to say, people go, God, how do you feel about how people have ruined your books? And he just turned around, pointed at his bookshelf. His books were up there. I don't know. Nobody seems to have ruined my books. They're right there. You know?
They're on the shelf just fine.
Yeah.
Let me ask you one parting question, because our topic for the regular show is celebrity deaths and how they impact
Troy, people. Troy, is this where Aaron's going to slip the knife between
exactly.
No, really no. I promise. Okay. I promise. No, because we were talking about celebrity deaths and how impactful they are for people that kind of almost, they feel like they're family. You work in the entertainment business, so you're on the other end of that to some degree, you know, with Matthew Perry recently passing away and stuff. Why do you, from your position, see why people in general are so impacted by a celebrity passing, sometimes more than their own family?
Well, because typically, you know, they know more about that celebrity than they know about people in their own family. They know more about them. Mm-hmm. They're more acquainted with them. They're a bigger part of their lives. You know, I've never met David Lynch, but I have. If he died, I'd be just really, really sad. Really sad. And mm-hmm. I know David Lynch better than I know my cousin Jim. You know, it's not that hard to explain. I think what these people do, and you know, people like Matt, especially online on camera talent. Mm-hmm. TV is different than movies. Getting into a TV show is like getting married. You get married to the TV show, and every week those people are in your home. And yeah. You know, it's been said many times, but never underestimate the power of that in your home. And so you are going, wow, what's going to happen to this person next? And, you know, when a show jumps the shark where it's like, you go, I don't think I'm going to watch anymore. I don't like mm-hmm. these characters anymore. They're in real life. We have friends jump the shark. Like say a friend who's a really close friend gets involved in a more romantic relationship with somebody who you can't stand. And maybe they get married to him. Maybe it's a committed relationship. You never see them again because that friend jumped the shark. We have relationships with these celebrities and with these mostly characters that celebrities play. And so, yeah, we're going to be engaged emotionally. And it's actually – it's not virtual. It's not fake. They're going to be engaged emotionally. It's real emotions by these people and by these characters. So, yeah. I mean, when some guys, when they die, it's like – I mean, that's why I think these guys have to be very careful. And, you know, you certainly don't want them dying of overdoses or suicide or things like that, because the last thing you want is for people to emulate that behavior, you know.
Thanks so much for coming on. Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Always good to see you, buddy.
I'd be happy to come on again anytime you guys want, because you guys are like my, you know, you're my OG's partners in crime on this stuff. But I mean, yeah, feel free if you want to cut this into two parts, and because we're running, people might get off fatigue, you know. I know my wife gets that. I guess that's what I'd say. It's your show. Do whatever the fuck you want with it.
Maybe we'll do it solo. Maybe we'll connect it. Yeah. We'll figure it out. We'll get it.
Yeah. Or you could do it into 10 parts.
I'll do 10 parts. I'll do 20 parts.
We'll do
the
first five and then charge $5 for the other five.
Somebody I'm going to do a podcast. I'm going to interview.
Yeah. No, we actually, we stopped doing most interviews just because, number one, I don't like interviewing actors.
Yeah.
You know, everything is a safe zone. They can only say approved responses. I always prefer directors or writers, because you guys are like, you made the world and you're open to discussing it.
Yeah.
Most interviews I've gotten away from, honestly.
You know the joke about the actor who goes out on a first date. He's just sitting there talking for like an hour and finally stops. He goes, "Oh my God," he says, "all I've been doing, I've been just talking about me. I mean, so what do you think of me?"
That's a great answer.
So true.
Anyway.
Okay. Thank you, Daniel, for that. Really appreciate you stopping by. That's it for this super long episode. I hope you guys really enjoyed it. And remember, the next time you head to the theater or stream comfortably on your couch, buy popcorn.